Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Pulling Heartstrings with the Matriarch here on your number one talk radio station, Eagle FM. Today is the 9th of the first month, 2026. It is a Friday evening and woo, woo, woo. We are within, we are within, we are within. So ladies and gentlemen, today was one of those hectic days in Windhoek City. And it's always a hectic day in Windhoek City. I think that, with the whole rush and let's get back to work and let's get life started. It is a bit of a hassle and a tassle, but it is getting there nonetheless. I hope you guys have had a pleasant evening and have enjoyed the shows that we had presented to you guys in the whole entire day. So, ladies and gentlemen, we were talking about our zodiac signs. Right. And with our zodiac signs, we're talking about, when in the month and what sign are you? And we spoke about, Aries being the 21st of March to April the 19th or 20th. 19th or 20th. Mm-hmm. You know, it's actually 19th. And then Taurus being, the 20th of April to the 20th of May, Gemini being the 21st of, May to the 20th of June, and then Cancer being the 21st of June to the 22nd of July, and Leo being 23 of July to August the 22nd, and Virgo being 23rd of August to the 22nd of September, and Libra being the 23rd of September to the 22nd of October, and Scorpio being October the 23rd to November the 21st, and Sagittarius being 22nd of November to the 21st of December, and Capricorn being the 22nd of December to the 19th of January, Aquarius being January the 20th, February to February the 18th, and last but not least, Pisces being February the 19th to March the 20th. Right. So if you're born between these days, then you belong to those signs, you know? So you just calculate like, okay, so my birthday is on the 25th of March. So I'm an Aries. Aha. So we were talking about the different characteristics that different signs have, and we're talking about how we can see what is actually meant by your star sign. And we spoke about all the signs, and we also ended up going with compatibility. So we're going to go with compatibility today, and we're going to be talking about the different signs and the different compatibilities and the different stages in which we as different star signs, right, interact with one another. And maybe, just maybe, these conversations are built to help us understand ourselves a little bit more, because I feel that we can fight battles from all sides. Like, guys, if it's a battle, let's fight it from all sides. If you're battling to understand who you are, or to understand what your purpose is in life and where you're supposed to be, because with astrology, there are also signs. There are signs underneath, but then there's also a different kind of is it fair to say astrology as well? Life path numbers. There are different life path numbers. Now, these different life path numbers also determine the type of person that you are, because I'm a life path number 8 and I'm an infinity sign. And infinity is a wonderful sign. It's great. It's like the 8 ball. It's great. But I like to believe that if we can understand ourselves from all areas, right, it you may never know what might push you to that point of getting things started, you know, getting things started, getting your life started, understanding yourself, pushing yourself to the absolute limits. Because if you know If you've never understood, like, for example, if you're a Cancer and you've never understood why it's so easy for you to detach from people, then at least now you understand, like, oh, okay. So because I gravitate between the ocean and the shores, right? I can adapt to anything. And that would mean that also, I can let go of things easily and I can also bring things in easily. But I am more of a trusting person. So if somebody breaks my trust, then there's just no way. And then you can understand yourself. And when you understand yourself a bit better, then you also know which people are for you and which people are not for you. You also understand that, okay, you understand how you feel. You understand why you think the way you think and how come things are the way they are in your life specifically. Because at the end of the day, right, we as human beings, there are so many things outside there or here in the world, right? And we might not know everything, but the little that we do know, I think it goes a long way. So the number in studio is 083-288-401. 083-288-401. If in case you wanted to know what star sign am I, what does the sign say about me, and if you want us to read your cards or something, you know, predict 2026 for you, then maybe, just maybe, we can do that as well. Because it is a new year and we are supposed to be in the vibes of the vibes, and we are vibing. Okay? We're supposed to be vibing. We're supposed to be getting somewhere. We're supposed to be moving towards a certain want and a certain need. So now, for this year, ladies and gentlemen, as we always start with our year, last year was trusting the process. And I think that many of us trusted the process and we were stressed out of our mind, but still trusting the process nonetheless. So I would like for you guys to give our anthem for the year, what it's going to be. I'll give you guys until the very end of January for us to find an anthem for this year. What are we going to be doing this year? And what are we going to be focusing on this year? Because if I had a choice in this one, I would just say, let's just focus on the bag, guys. Let's focus on the bag. Let's leave all these other funny things. Let's just focus on the bag. Let's get the money. Let's get the cheese. Let's get the guala. Let's get the guaps. I would say let's focus on the bag, but the bag is not the only important thing, because we are human beings and we also have emotions and the list goes on. You can also get betrayed. You can also betray others. It is up and about and it's everywhere. So nonetheless. So also, I would like for us to come up with our anthem for the year. What are we doing this year? And also our vision boards. I want us to check off our vision boards. I want you to check off the board that you made last year, January, and see if you had accomplished the goals that you set out for yourself. If you have accomplished the things that you said that you would accomplish, you know, if you're holding yourself accountable to the things that you have not accomplished and asking yourself why you would have to take these resolutions or these visions or these wants onto the next year because they were not fulfilled in 12 months. So I want you guys to look at your vision boards and, or look through your notes and ask yourself, why weren't certain things done and when are they going to be done? Because just because you didn't do them last year doesn't mean that they are not important. Doesn't mean that they don't still need to be done. It just means that you didn't do it last year, but you have 12 months to try and accomplish them this year. We are starting our year with hope. We are starting our year with ambition. We're starting our year with dramatics and theatrics. We're starting our year with grace, with humility, with love, with care, with the bag. We're starting it with the bag. Money. We're starting it with the bag. And we are also allowing, you know, our maker. We're allowing our maker to disperse of things that we no longer need and to let go of things that we no longer need and things that no longer serve us and things that, that you cannot tolerate anymore. So we are allowing the sweeping to happen. Sometimes we feel that, sometimes we feel that our things are going to get lost in the sweeping. But in all honesty, I think that trusting your maker is a very important thing, because your maker is your maker. We traveled through this holiday. We traveled through a lot of Namibia. Like, we can't say a lot of Namibia. I would say from the northeast of Namibia. So we decided that we are going to drop the children off. We dropped the children off and we proceeded to be having fun. And by having fun, I mean sleeping. Like, hey, as adults, I don't know. I don't know how you guys go out and have fun and still have energy to be adults and parents and stuff like that. So we did a lot of sleeping this holiday. But then also part of the things that we did was also spend time with a friend of mine. And we spend a lot of time with them. And we spend a lot of time alone as well, you know, talking and ironing throughout through our stuff and through our lives and seeing and sleeping and eating mangoes, because it was mango season. So we're eating mangoes and we're eating and we're having the time of our lives. We're in Ongwediva and we're at the park. I strongly believe that that park, whoever the architect of that park is, I think that he or she is immaculate. You know, like they really designed a very, very good thing. I think that it's only under marketed and under advertised, but it was nice. We spent about 10 days there, or six days, and then we head off to Korihas. We went to Korihas and we drove through the Ochuarongo Road, and it was a beautiful scenery. So one of the things that I said along the way of our adventures was that God is an artist. God is an artist, and God is a perfectionist. It might not look perfect, but it is perfectly made. And so are we, right? We as people, we are perfectly made, and there is nothing that is amiss. There's nothing that's lacking. We are absolutely wonderful. We are absolutely amazing. If we must say so. I was looking at the landscape of Namibia, and there were so many tourist cars wherever we went. There's so many tourist cars, and we also had to drive to Kamanya, and it was nice, man. It was one of those rides where we spent a lot of time in the car. But it was pleasant, because there was no fuss and there was no fight. And for those that got to spend their holidays with their children against their will, I would like for you to take 2 weeks out of being a parent. And go and try and rediscover who you are without the children. Because many of us drown in the personality of parents, and we don't realize how crippling it is. And we don't realize how not nice it is. Because when we're with the children, or when we're surrounded by the children, everything is about the children. Every single thing is about the children. You don't have a moment. And even when you're snapping, you're snapping and there is someone in the background, and the children. And of course, the children are a priority. They are important. They are everything. But I think for this holiday, I really put my foot down. You know, when it came to being a mom, I checked out. Like, I left them with a person that is capable, right? Because they are my mother. And they mothered me, you know, a fellow mom. And we went. And it was, first of all, it started off as something that was very anxious. We talked about the kids a lot. For the first 2 days, we talked about the kids a lot, and it was just the kids. But then later on, it became a conversation about something else. And I think that that is what every parent needs. As much as you need leave from work, as much as you need leave from the city, I think you also need leave from your children. And sometimes you need leave from your spouse. It doesn't mean you love them less. It doesn't mean that you guys are not together, you guys are not chilling, you guys are not bumping it. It just means, right, that it's some you time for a little while. Some you time where you can decide if you're going to have a messy house, or you're going to take bubble baths, or you're going to take long baths, or you're going to go to the massage, or you're going to eat chocolate, or whatever you choose to do, right? You do it with a due diligence, and you do it for you. And that is why we're talking about our star signs, because maybe, just maybe, we can understand. We can understand ourselves from different areas. We can understand ourselves from different perspectives and different beliefs and different. Many people don't talk about astrology. Many people don't talk about reading cards. Many people don't really talk about your birth chart and the zodiacs. Many people don't. And even, and interestingly enough, even in the Chinese, denomination, there are also zodiacs, you know, and I don't know what they're called, but they're also zodiacs under the Chinese calendar, and this is something that has been there for a very long time. So I'm just saying, let us broaden our minds and allow our minds to run a little wild, to see exactly where we're going to place ourselves and how we're going to place ourselves. And in that, we can maybe, just maybe, understand ourselves a little bit better. And who better to explain astrology than an astrologist themselves? How can we, as the layman, explain astrology when we are not astrologists? So, ladies and gentlemen, you know how we do on our Fridays. Our Fridays, we allow others to teach us. And today we're being taught astrology explained by a professional astrologer, Professor Kama. So, ladies and gentlemen, please stay tuned. And also keep in mind that we, as Eagle Media House, do not claim any ownership of the clip that we're going to be playing. It is strictly for learning purposes. It is strictly for entertainment. It is strictly for a broadening of a perspective that we do need. So, enjoy, and I will see you in the next few minutes.
In this interview with Chris Brennan, you get to meet the genius behind the astrology podcast and find out why it's so popular. People love tuning in and finding out what's coming next and how to implement it in their lives. Wait till you hear from Chris himself. So, Chris, let me thank you so much for taking the time to be with us here today. I'm so excited about where this conversation might take us.
Yeah, thanks a lot for having me today. I'm excited as well.
So, you are kind of on the young side of astrologers in this day and age. So, how did this whole astrology thing get started in your life?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, a lot of astrologers, more established astrologers, are sort of came in the wave during the 1960s and 70s. But I actually found astrology when I was in high school in the late 90s and early 2000s, and just was really fascinated by it and decided that that's what I wanted to spend my life studying. So I actually went to school and studied astrology in college and then continued to pursue it afterwards.
So you say you came across it in high school. Tell me a little bit more about that. What happened? Why did it stick?
Sure. So, I mean, I was always aware of like sun signs in newspapers and things like that. And that was kind of novel on some level. But it was when I discovered the concept of the birth chart and that there's different planets that astrologers pay attention to besides just the sun sign. And each planet can be in different signs of the zodiac in a person's birth chart. And that all comes together in a more complex way to say something about the nature and future of a person's life.
And why was that interesting to you?
Just because it's something that seemed like it shouldn't work, but the more I paid attention to it and started to work with it and study its history and philosophy, I was surprised that something like that could actually work or have anything to say about a person's character or future or destiny.
Yeah, I think you're right. In my head, it works the same way. It shouldn't work. And sure. Then when you do a birth chart, and it hits eerily close, you're kind of like, wait a minute, there might be something here. So
yeah,
what was one of the most interesting things that connected with you personally about your birth chart?
I mean, one of the most interesting things in retrospect was sometimes, in my experience and sometimes seeing other younger people, the way that it can sometimes describe events that will happen in their life that haven't happened yet and may seem to not connect initially when a person's younger. But as you get older, you sort of grow into your life a little bit more, and sometimes life takes you in interesting and unexpected directions that sometimes end up matching exactly what the birth chart said, much to your surprise. And I think that's one of the most fun and like interesting experiences for me.
So that is interesting, because a lot of times with astrology, we look for it to tell us how we're going to feel today, or, you know, things that might happen for us, and that we don't realize them until in retrospect, that all of this sort of comes together. I noticed that you really are digging in with this ancient art of astrology. What is it in you that connects with this Hellenistic or, you know, ancient astrology practice?
Yeah, I think it was just the fact that I discovered when I was in college and studying the history of astrology that astrology used to be a lot more different in the ancient world 2000 years ago in like the Roman Empire when it first started compared to today. And there was a lot of interesting advanced techniques and timing techniques and different philosophical concepts that existed back then that made astrology a little bit more effective as a predictive system than it became in the 20th century, because it kept getting transmitted from culture to culture and language to language. And every time that happened over the past 2000 years, some things were lost and other things were added until it was a lot different in 20th century astrology compared to 2000 years ago. So part of my goal in life has been to go back and recover some of those ancient techniques and bring the useful ones forward to today.
So how did that, when it was developed, you're talking about, how did they start saying, okay, these alignment of planets in the heavens actually affect me here on this planet we call Earth? How did they start that whole connection?
Sure. I think it just started very basically with, you had these long families of sky watchers that would go out every day and every night and look at the stars and write down their observations, not just when they would see an interesting astrological alignment or see something happen in the sky that was notable astronomically, but they would also sometimes note down what events took place in their city or in the world in general at that time. Like, for example, if there was a major eclipse and a king died, they would write that down and add that to like a library or a repository of information. And after many, many generations, they built up enough observations of those correlations to start working out some of the basic principles.
That's really interesting. So then it just kept growing from there. So first it was observational. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, it was observational and very empirical, because they were just looking at significant astronomical alignments, and they would pay attention to what types of events happened at the same time simultaneously, under the premise not necessarily that the stars were causing those events to happen, but that there was some sort of correlation or some sort of synchronicity that was indicating a connection between them through a similarity in meaning, even if they weren't causally related.
Okay, so you mentioned there were some things from this ancient practice of astrology that you felt like was important to bring forward. What's one or two of those and why?
Sure. So one of the most basic concepts that didn't survive into modern astrology that we found in recovering ancient astrology over the past 30 years or so is the concept of sect, which is the distinction between day charts and night charts, where the very first thing an ancient astrologer would pay attention to is they would look to determine if a person was born during the day or if they were born at night. And this would alter the interpretation of the birth chart in a very significant way. Which makes sense because that's one of the most obvious sort of astronomical distinctions that we all experience, you know, on a day-to-day basis is just, is it daytime and is it bright out or is it nighttime and is it dark out? But for some reason, that concept didn't survive or wasn't passed on through the generations of astrologers due to the decline of astrology in the 17th century after the Renaissance. So that's one really important concept that we recovered. And then there was another important category of techniques from ancient Greek astrology known as the Time Lord systems, which were different systems for dividing a person's life up into chapters and subsections as if the life was a book and you could identify when each chapter of your life began and when each chapter ends. So the sort of interesting, sort of exotic timing techniques for determining things about when certain things will happen in a person's life.
So do you bring that forward in your practice now?
Yeah, that's one of the major techniques that I talk about in my book and that I've used in all consultations that I've done over the past 15 years or so in order to see how the theory of the technique as it's written down in some of the ancient Greek texts actually applies to people's lives today. And it's been really fascinating applying it, especially to the charts of like celebrities or actors or politicians. Like, for example, this technique from the It's from a second century text by an author named Vedius Valens, who lived in Egypt, in Alexandria, around 150 CE. And using this technique, if you apply it to a modern actor's chart, like, for example, Robert Downey Jr., it indicated that he would have a major career transition and begin a major career peak that would last for 20 years, starting around 2008. And what happened is that that was when the Iron Man movie came out, and his career suddenly was given a second breath of life and really took off. And he became eventually for a period of time, like the highest paid actor in Hollywood. So seeing a technique that we're just taking out of a second century text to be able to do something like that was really striking or really stunning.
So something you said about that, how does it affect someone like Robert Downey Jr., who probably had that all happen unbeknownst to him? What happens if you're talking to him and you're telling him this is what's going to happen? Does it affect how he lives his life and how he makes those decisions?
Sure, potentially. I mean, he's one of the major actors that actually does consult with astrologers and has endorsed different astrologers at different periods of time. So I think he is getting some advice when it comes to things like that. But for the most part, I think with some of those broad level techniques, especially for people where their career is not an astrologer, much of that stuff is happening independently, regardless of if they're aware of it or not, because some of it has to do with not just actions and choices they're taking, but also the circumstances in their life that are available to them at that time. And sometimes, you know, about 50% of the stuff in our life is very much outside of our control and are just things that we react to based on opportunities that are available to us at the time.
So for someone like me, you know, how do I take astrology? If I were working with you, how do you help me take all of these signs and information and help me implement them in my life so that I live a better life?
Sure. I mean, I think one of the ways is it just helps to give you some perspective on the events that are happening in your life and some reassurance sometimes when you're at a crucial turning point, that sometimes things will work out for the best, or in some instances that you're on the right track, or that even if you're going through a difficult time, that it might have an end point at a certain point, or it might be building up to something greater. Some of that is just reassuring and can help to give you some greater outside perspective on your life in a unique way than you might be used to. And for some people, that's kind of reassuring.
So do you feel like astrology is something that was interesting to you, so you followed it, or was there a deeper connection or calling for you?
Yeah, I mean, for myself, using the same technique I was just talking about with Robert Downey Jr., it said that I would start a major career peak period right about the time that I discovered astrology. So that's a joke that I make in my book, that you know an astrology technique is good when the technique itself tells you that you found it at that time in your life.
Yeah, that's great. So I know you have a podcast, you talk to a lot of astrologers. Is this where you spend your life?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's just really fascinating as a whole subculture that exists in the modern world, that there's, you know, groups of astrologers that are doing things like this and looking at birth charts and consulting with, and sometimes giving advice to not just actors, but sometimes like politicians or other people in the world, and just the influence that astrology has in that way. So part of my goal is just to document that and talk about not just the history in the past, but also try to get interviews with different astrologers in the present in order to document who's doing what and what sort of contributions they're making during the course of their career or their life.
So what are some different areas? I know you talk with astrologers that have all different areas of expertise. What are some of those different areas that they address?
Sure. So, I mean, there's one type of astrology, which is natal astrology and looking at birth charts, but there's also different branches of astrology, such as mundane astrology, for example, is looking at large groups of people like cities and nations, or trying to predict world events. So, for example, last year with the pandemic and the alignment of planets that all lined up in a line, literally in the sign of Capricorn last year, about the time that the lockdowns took place, that was something that was more in the realm of mundane astrology and trying to forecast stuff that's affecting large groups of people at the same time. So that's one specialty. Or electional astrology is another specialty, which is trying to determine auspicious times to act. And when you launch a new venture or project, that there's going to be some dates that are going to be more auspicious, whereas there's going to be other dates that might be more challenging, or when the success of the venture might be less, as not as much as you hoped for.
So what are this mundane astrology? Sounds anything but mundane to me. This whole like right. societal movement, or what's happening with lockdowns worldwide. What insights have you gotten? For yourself or from others, based on where we are at this time in history?
Yeah, well, that's very much what interests me the most. And one of the things that's most striking about the work of Richard Tarnas and his connection with the Changing of the Gods series is that he was one of the few astrologers that wrote a book in 2006 that really specialized in and focused on mundane astrology. And he looked at specific planetary cycles that would recur at different times and talked about what they've correlated with in the past. And so what was interesting about that is, if you read his book, he talked about how the Saturn-Pluto conjunctions, like the one in 1981, coincided with the beginning of the AIDS pandemic. So he had shown how it had a history of coinciding with pandemics in the past. And then part of the inference then was, when that conjunction recurred in the future, it could potentially recur with something like that again at some point. And then, of course, at the beginning of 2020, was the next time we had a Saturn-Pluto conjunction. So I think we all the astrologers, like, learned something significant about that, as well as just the need to sometimes, astrologers worry a lot about not freaking people out too much, or not coming off as overly negative, as a bit of like self-reflection and not wanting to influence people in an unduly negative fashion. But one of the things I kind of learned from that is that sometimes when you do see something challenging coming up, sometimes it's better to be open and honest about if it looks difficult rather than not, because otherwise you could be holding back something that's really important.
Yeah, I've been here long enough that there's times of ease and times of difficulty, right? And having right. a reason for that difficulty, you're right. It's like, don't freak people out. But when you know what's going to happen, you can prepare in advance and I think have a broader view. Do you think that that's what astrology helps with?
Yeah, just getting a broader view and some perspective, as well as some idea of time frames involved and like how long something might last, or when the most tense parts might be and different things like that. I think knowing the duration of difficult things even can be very reassuring. And even if that's all you could do with astrology, like, that in and of itself would be very helpful.
Yeah, I think knowing something's going to end that's difficult or painful, just knowing that. Because when you're in it, you feel like that's the sum total of reality, right? So what are some individual ways you work with people one-on-one? What are some individual ways that astrology has helped people cope with what's been going on in our world?
I think that there's different people that it hit different areas of their life harder. I mean, there's some people where it hit their relationships really hard. There's other people where it hit their career very hard and impacted or interrupted things they were working on. There's other people where there were other relationships in their life with their parents or children or siblings that it impacted the most. And sometimes just being able to see through a different lens how some of the things they've been experiencing were actually reflected in their chart and showed up indicating that that would be the area where they might experience the brunt of some of those energies at the time was just helpful in terms of getting some perspective on that at the time and working through whatever the issue was or whatever the hardship was at the time.
Okay, so if I'm hearing you correctly, it's okay, this has been really tough on my relationships, and you're able to tell me, okay, in your chart, this is a time where you're defining those relationships. It's having that broader picture, but also I think maybe making it apply as a purpose to my life, not just this random difficulty, right? Like, I think random difficulty leads to why me?
Yeah, I think one of the most sort of uncomfortable, hopeless feelings in the world is that the world is just like this random, meaningless place where stuff just happens to you and there's no real rhyme or reason to it. But one of the really unique viewpoints that astrology gives or that it brings, I think, from the ancient world where they had much more like intricate and sort of interesting conceptualizations of fate, and fate not just being something that was negative or overbearing or oppressive, but could sometimes indicate broader narratives of like meaning and purpose in a person's life. I think importing and trying to identify the larger narrative of a person's life and why certain events are taking place at other times. And that even if we're experiencing something where a door is being shut on one part of our life or one relationship, that it might be opening up other doors in the future. And there might be some sort of like productive or constructive reason for some of these difficulties. I think that's a really useful perspective to have that you might not be able to have otherwise.
So you keep hitting on this theme of a broader purpose to life, the reason why things are happening. And I think that's the universal thing all humans ask, right? What we seek for. When did it hit you that you were finding that through astrology?
I think relatively early on, because I would go back and one of the first things I think most astrologers do when they get into it is they go back and look at their past life chronology up to that point, and they look at some of the events in their life that occurred, and then they look and see what the alignment of the planets were at that time. And what's really striking about that is usually the symbolic meaning of just if you look up the interpretation of different things in the astrology books of what certain alignments are supposed to mean will actually then match up with your past life events, which ends up being a really startling realization that much of your life up to this point has been indicated or has correlated in this really weird way with major planetary alignments in your birth chart. So I think when you do that and have that realization and then continue to practice astrology while living your life, you know, somewhat independently and having different types of events take place in your life, but then continuing to see some of those patterns and correlations play out, I think it just helps to reinforce that there's something very weird going on here that, you know, perhaps for any normal person shouldn't be happening, but for some reason it is. And so it's kind of hard to not be interested or fascinated by that and to want to learn and understand it as best as you can.
So does that mean, based on the stars, my life's going to be a certain way, and that's just how it is?
No, I mean, because while part of it are some things are going to be outside of your control, some things are also going to be acts of personal volition, and we all make choices that impact and alter the course of our life in very significant ways. It's just the astrology sometimes, for some mysterious reason, tends to know ahead of time when some of those pivotal turning points are going to take place, where you're going to make an important choice that's going to take you in one direction or another. And that's part of the mystery, but also the thing that's interesting about it.
So let's say I have a really important choice coming up in this next year for me. Mm. It's a pivotal time. I have a super important choice to make. How does astrology help me become prepared for that rather than pressurized by it?
Just by giving you some idea that in a broad archetypal or general sense that some of the most important choices or most important areas of your life that are going to be activated in the coming year are going to be this, let's say, selection of four or five areas. And so that most of your focus is probably going to be on those areas, and most of the important choices that you're going to make is going to happen in that area over the course of the next 12 months. So once you know that and know the general range of things, you can maybe sometimes narrow down what you focus on or what you sort of anticipate is coming up as either really constructive and really easy areas of your life during certain periods or otherwise somewhat challenging areas of your life during other periods. But having a little bit of foreknowledge sometimes just gives you a heads up ahead of time, so you're not completely caught off guard by anything.
It sounds to me like having a map. You kind of have an idea of where you're going instead of just guessing, right?
Yeah, I think that's a really good analogy. It is a map. And actually the birth chart, that was the Greek term for it, as they would call it, like a map, basically, or that was like a shorthand term for it. And it's a good analogy of using a map for astrology also, because a map does give you kind of like a top-down view of everything, like a bird's eye view of the landscape and sort of the general outlines of where to go in order to get from point A to point B. But at the same time, it doesn't give you everything. It's not like looking at a crystal ball into exactly, or like a movie of exactly what will happen. And there's still a quite different experience of actually being there and living through those events firsthand and seeing them come alive in a much more nuanced fashion once you actually experience them. So I think that's a really good analogy, because it highlights both the advantages but also some of the limitations of astrology.
Yeah, it's not. So you hit on something that was a question I couldn't wait to ask you, and that's, what's the difference between, you know, the astrology chart I get where it says, here's your sign, these are the things you need to look at. It's like, you know, your sign is based on roughly a month, right? Anywhere in there. Mm-hmm. Versus a birth chart. For someone who doesn't know what a birth chart is, what is that, and how does it compare with what a lot of us know as, you know, our signs predictions for the month?
Sure. So the basic one, which is your sun sign, just indicates, it's just based on the month you were born. And it indicates that anybody born within that 1 month time span would have the sun in one of 12 signs of the zodiac. But the difference between that, which is somewhat limited because it's just taking into account one celestial body in our solar system, which is the sun. But then you realize that there's, you know, 9 or 10 other planets in the solar system besides the sun, including the moon. And each of them moves at different speeds or moves at different rates through the signs of the zodiac and spends different amounts of time there. So some of them move really quickly, like the moon only spends about 2 or 3 days in each sign of the zodiac. So that can be in one of 12 different signs for you. And it's going to indicate something different about your personality than your sun sign. And then there's other planets like Mars spends 2.5 years in each sign. It takes 2.5 years to go around all 12 signs. So it spends about a month or so in each, sometimes 2 months. Jupiter spends a year in each sign. Saturn spends about 2 or 3 years in each sign. So there's different planets that are moving around at different speeds through the different signs of the zodiac, and those all give you different variables that make up a much more nuanced and detailed picture of your life and your personality compared to just paying attention to one single variable.
Yeah, so I had a friend who did their birth chart, and they had their time of birth wrong. And they were like, oh, this doesn't make any sense. And then when they got their time right, it was zeroed in. Why does that little bit, like same day, same place, that little bit of time of hours make such a big difference?
Yeah, I mean, it's a little hard to explain, but the time of birth is tied into the rising sign, which is the sign of the zodiac that was rising up over the eastern horizon where the sun rises each morning. And that sign of the zodiac actually turns out to be the most personal one to you, because the ascendant or the rising sign changes about every 2 hours. So it moves very rapidly. So that means because it moves so rapidly through the 12 signs of the zodiac, it's actually the most unique one for you. Whereas, for example, the sun sign, the sun will be the same for everybody born in the same month, or the moon sign will be the same for everybody born during a, let's say, 2 or 3 day period, whereas the rising sign only stays true for like an hour or two each day. So it's much more unique in that way and much more personally tied in with you. But that brings up, you know, another type of astrology or branch, which is rectification, which is when a person doesn't know their birth time or they only know it approximately, an astrologer can sit down with them for, let's say, a 2-hour consultation and ask them questions about their life. At the end of that 2-hour process, a person can somewhat reliably reverse engineer what time a person was born based on the events that occurred so far in their life. So that's another branch of astrology that some astrologers specialize in, is just helping people to identify what their correct rising sign is or what time they were born, based on reverse engineering it based on the events that have occurred so far in their life.
Yeah, that's interesting, because I've had people ask me, what do you do if you don't know what time you were born? So that's really, really interesting that you can find that out. I also want to know, what has been the most fascinating or surprising thing you have found out interviewing other astrologers?
The most fascinating or surprising thing that I've found out in interviewing other astrologers is just that astrology seems to act as like a language. And in many ancient astrologers in like ancient Mesopotamia, they had this analogy that astrology was like a language that was written across the sky, and that it was kind of like the gods were communicating to humankind through the movement of the stars and the planets. And what's interesting about that in modern times is that astrology does seem to act as a language, and that there's many different ways that you can use it, not just in applications of astrology, but there's many different schools and traditions of astrology where sometimes they'll develop their own unique applications of the subject that still work, but work in ways that are very different. And I think it's kind of like the best analogy is a language, where once you learn a language, sometimes there can be drift and it can change, but still be sort of consistent in and of itself. Sort of like how in Europe you have a relatively small area of land, but when you go across different boundaries, there will all of a sudden be people speaking very different languages, like French, German, Spanish, what have you. There's something similar in the astrological community, where there's different types of astrology that all work, even if they have a different form of like syntax and structure.
So I like that it's this language and you're all studying it. So you have this base to work from, right? So for someone who doesn't understand all these different branches of astrology, what is your most singular focus?
My most singular focus is primarily natal astrology, which is just that application of looking at the alignment of the planet at the moment a person was born, under the premise that that'll tell you something about the nature of their life as well as their future. I think at the most basic, that's my primary focus.
So that's interesting, because in watching some of your things, you talk about most astrologers say, this is for a Libra, this is for an Aries, this is for Virgo, and you talk about this is for this person and that rising sign. Why is that so significant?
Just because the rising sign, it's connected with this ancient technique or concept that was introduced around the first century BCE, where you determine what the rising sign is, and then that helps you to establish a set of 12 what's called houses or sectors of the chart that divides the chart into 12 sections that pertain to different areas of the person's life. And the 12 areas are things like body, finances, communication, home and living situation, children, work, relationships, shared resources, travel, career, friends, and enemies or people that you don't get along with. And once you know the rising sign, you can establish those 12 areas of the chart, and that allows you to make much more specific statements about, depending on where the planets will be over the course of the next year, which areas of the person's life are going to be more active and become more of the focus during the course of that period of time. So it allows for much more specific sort of forecasts or predictions about the future.
So you say the 12 areas, which are only, as you listed them, I'm thinking, all the most important things to all of us, right? That's right. That's it. And so is that more important than your sun sign?
Yeah, I would say so. I think while your sun sign can be important, the sun sign is especially going to be more important for people who are born during the day, whereas actually if a person was born at night, either before sunrise or after sunset, their moon sign is actually more important to them. But whether you're born during the day or at night, your rising sign is still going to be the most unique, and the houses are going to be the best way to approach specific predictions about a person's life.
So can you tell us a time when someone came to you, didn't know much about astrology and learning about astrology and what you do and about themselves helped them realize a specific event or a specific decision that changed the direction of their life that maybe they wouldn't have had otherwise?
I mean, the best like analogy I can actually come up with for that, or best example of that, that kind of comes to mind is when I first met my partner, we were hanging out at like a library one day, and we're both astrologers that met at an astrology meeting. And this is like 13 or 14 years ago. And we looked at each other's charts and just like made a few comments. And I made a few statements about her chart. And she was actually very open about it and very like blunt about it, and just being like, that is not true and has like no relation to anything that's occurred in my life up to this point. And I was like, okay, that's too bad. We'll see what happens. And what's funny is like quite independently of anything else over the past decade, like she ended up going on a specific career path. And most of the things that I ended up saying ended up working out, not because she wanted them to or was influenced by anything I had said, but quite independently of that, just like that's where her life ended up going, but it hadn't up until that point. And it's sort of a funny running joke to us that I get to bring up then over again on the podcast, just to sort of mess with her from time to time, that, for example, she became the head of a major astrological organization. That's one of the major astrology organizations around the world. She became the president of it. And up to that point, she hadn't done any like community organizing efforts. So my statement wasn't true, but I was picking up on something that would become important in her life at some point. But I always think of that example just because it didn't really push her in that direction or influence her to, but instead she was kind of dragged into that area, almost like, you know, being picked up in a riptide or an ocean current or something that sort of takes you in a direction you're not originally anticipating that you'll go, even if that direction ends up being fortuitous in some way.
Yeah, it sounds like it was against her will or wishes, right? Like at the time, it's what was happening.
Yeah, because it ended up being like a lot of work. I mean, it was very important, and she ended up winning awards and like accolades in the community later as a result of that. But it was definitely taking on a big burden and doing sort of community service work at the time at a stage in her career where she didn't think she was fully prepared to do that. But it ended up being ultimately a good thing that she did, even though she kind of stumbled into it in the end.
So you say stumbled into it. You knew it was coming.
I had an idea. I was just reading the chart and I was just saying what the chart said, and it seemed to be indicating that working in groups and for social movements would become an important part of her life, especially ones that were tied in with her beliefs and her philosophical interests, one of the primary ones of which was astrology. So it was like a pretty straightforward interpretation of the placement in her chart. It just hadn't happened yet.
That's so great. I love that. So for someone who doesn't really know much about astrology, is looking into it, wants to know how it can affect their lives, kind of someone on the fringe, what's the most important thing for them to know?
I think the most important thing is just to try to get a hold of an accurate birth time. Try to see if you can figure out your birth time, because that's the foundation of most of the birth chart and most of the techniques that astrologers use in terms of advanced techniques, either by asking your parents if they remember, or better yet, trying to find your birth time from your birth certificate, and then going to, you know, a website. There's lots of free websites and apps out there today that you can access in order to calculate your birth chart. And I would just recommend doing that as a starting point so that you are accurately looking at the same thing that astrologers do in order to assess whether or not there seems to be anything to astrology. And the best test is to do that and then go back through your past life and look at events and where the planets were at those different times when important turning points in your life occurred, and see if there were important planetary alignments with your birth chart at that time. And I think once you do that, it'll set a foundation and sort of open up a whole new world for you, sometimes unexpectedly. But once you've seen it, it's kind of hard to look away.
Yeah, I think that's good. It's in order to learn it, experience it. That's really what you're saying, right? And I'm going to add, necessarily don't trust your mother, because my mother gave me a time that ended up being different than what was on my birth certificate. So what are some ways people can find that out?
Yeah, that's really common, because actually most astrologers are constantly encouraging people to not rely on the parents' memories unless you don't have a choice, because there's usually like so much going on during the process of birth. And sometimes, you know, there can be like sedatives involved and stuff like that, where, it's not a good idea to rely on the parents' memory if you have a choice. So the best thing is to get a copy of your birth certificate, especially an original copy. And usually there's websites you can go to at this point where you can order a copy from the state and they'll send you like a copy of the original birth certificate, and that'll have it. And usually that's the best thing. Other times, sometimes if you have like a baby book or something like that, sometimes it'll be written on that or some other birth record.
Okay, that's great. When you explained how the rising sign changes so often, it occurred to me how important those times really actually are. So now we're going to go to the other end of the spectrum. For someone who thinks they know a lot about astrology or even studies astrology, you know, I find it interesting this story you shared. You were sharing things about a chart with a fellow astrologer that you were seeing that they weren't. So for someone who studies it or is in the space, maybe what are some of the most important things for them to know?
Yeah, I think just having conversations with other astrologers, especially ones that don't necessarily practice the approach that you practice, can be really helpful and can really open your eyes up to new perspectives that you maybe hadn't seen before. And that was part of my experience going to college. Was I started learning modern astrology for the first 4 or 5 years of my studies, and I was very adamant about that being the best approach. And when I went to school, they sort of forced me to start taking some courses on ancient Greek and Roman astrology, as well as ancient Indian astrology. And at first I protested it, because my conceptualization at the time was that those older approaches were like old and outdated and no longer relevant, because we had discovered new planets since then and life had changed so much that there's no way that something from 2000 years ago could be relevant. But eventually my protest kind of failed, and they were just like, you know, tough, suck it up and take the course. Otherwise you're not going to pass and graduate. So I did, and very quickly realized that my initial presumptions about other forms of astrology, especially older forms, were wrong, and that there were a number of things that had been lost that we could actually recover that would be useful for modern contemporary astrology. And I also realized that when you start reading some of the ancient texts from 2000 years ago, where they're sharing birth charts, and sometimes the astrologers from back then, like Vedius Valens, will share their own birth chart in their text and talk about their life story, you realize very quickly that life today is actually very similar as it was back then, because the fundamental areas of life haven't changed that much in terms of like relationships, you know, parents, your career, travel, communication, finances, stuff like that. It's all largely the same, even if the details have changed. And that's, I think, why a system that was developed 2000 years ago can still be relevant today, because they actually tuned into something that was very fundamental about the core principles of life.
Wow, what a great place to end, that this all ties together with our shared core principles of life and gives us a map for greater meaning and understanding of that.
Right.
So thank you so much for sharing your wisdom and your experience and your knowledge with us today. It's been quite a journey.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for having me today. And I'm excited about this series, and I'm excited to see the other interviews you've done.
The views and opinions expressed by our guests and callers are not those of Eagle FM and any of its
Eagle FM lets you express your constitutional rights of freedom of expression without fear of favor.
This is actually, to put it mildly, an economic scandal.
Fraud.
Not fraud, it's a scandal.
Scandal.
Why do you give a tender to somebody who does not have capacity to build? Why should you do that? You know a person that does not have the capacity to build.
Eagle FM lets you talk.
That's why I'm always telling people in Parliament, let me not take up my Katatura manners.
Right.
Because I grew up in Katatura.
Uh-huh.
And I will not hesitate to tell you off if it is needed to do.
Be part of the debate by setting the agenda.
My response in terms of Rwanda at 6% is that we had been there before. We've had 6% growth before.
Mm.
It's not something that Namibia has not achieved in the past.
Mm.
And it's not something that Namibia will not be able to achieve in the future.
Eagle FM, Eagle FM lets you express your constitutional rights of freedom of expression without fear of favor.
This is actually, to put it mildly, an economic scandal.
Fraud.
Not fraud, it's a scandal.
Scandal.
Why do you give a tender to somebody who does not have capacity to build? Why should you do that? You know a person that does not have the capacity to build.
Eagle FM lets you talk.
That's why I'm always telling people in Parliament, let me not take up my Katatura manners.
Right.
Because I grew up in Katatura.
Uh-huh.
And I will not hesitate to tell you off if it is needed to
be part of the debate by setting the agenda.
My response in terms of Rwanda at 6% is that we had been there before. We've had 6% growth before.
Mm.
It's not something that Namibia has not achieved in the past.
Mm.
And it's not something that Namibia will not be able to achieve in the future.
Eagle FM, the eye.
My friend, why do you seem so worried?
Ace, I'm planning an event for next weekend, eh? And I don't know how to best get people to hear about it.
Saima, don't worry about those small things. Contact Eagle FM today. Eagle FM has a dedicated team that can travel anywhere countrywide to broadcast live at any event, such as a promotion, organizational launch, anniversary, wedding, funeral, political or traditional and church events, and basically any event that you wish to broadcast on a national level. Call them now and talk to Monica at 081-270-3727 or the office number 083-288-400. Eagle FM, the eye.
Alrighty, good evening to you, ladies and gentlemen. If you have just joined us, you are listening to The Matriarch here on your number one talk radio station. And today we are just unwinding and we are just allowing others to lead us. And we had a professor that was talking about astrology. And I think that from there on, I think we fully understand astrology. And there's nothing more to add to it and nothing more to subtract from it. And it is what it is. I think it was well explained. It has to do with your birth charts, the time of birth, where you were born, your parents, what time was it it kind of determines what type of life you're going to be having. So without further ado, ladies and gentlemen, we are now diving into the world of stoicism.
Today you're going to learn a little bit about what the Stoics mean by being a good human being. We'll learn to live more rationally, to conduct a life based on reason, and to deal with our emotions in the best way we can. I am Massimo Piolucci. I am an evolutionary biologist and a philosopher of science, and my latest book is called Beyond Stoicism, co-authored with Greg Lopez and Meredith Kunz. Chapter 1. What is Stoicism? Stoicism is a philosophy of life that suggests that the best way to live a human life is to ask yourself what kind of a living organism human beings are. And the answer that the Stoics give to that question is that fundamentally we are highly social and capable of reason. We're very intelligent. It follows, according to them, that a good human life is one where you use reason in order to solve problems and you behave in a cooperative, pro-social fashion. One of the crucial insights of the Stoics is that we should focus on what is up to us, as the ancient Stoic Epictetus put it, and try to accept with equanimity what is not up to us. In other words, focus where your agency is active, where you are efficacious in doing things, and then accept whatever comes as it comes, because you really don't have a choice. The Stoics are nothing if not realists about life. They try to understand how human life works, and they try to live the best life possible. One of the things that we do understand from biology, psychology, is that we have limited time and energy to do things, both physical energy and emotional energy. And so if we insist on pursuing approaches that are likely not to work, or they're not efficacious, they're not, our agency doesn't really have any effect on it, then we are only making our life miserable. And in fact, we're trading off with other things that we should be doing. One of the interesting aspects of the particular brand of Stoicism, so to speak, that Epictetus articulated in the second century is this notion of role ethics. We all play different roles in life. Many roles, in fact. And if we reflect on it for a minute, for instance, some of my roles include being somebody's son, being somebody's father, being somebody's husband, being a friend, being a teacher, being a colleague, being a citizen of a particular nation, and of a particular city, and so on and so forth. All of these roles need to be handled essentially simultaneously. It's not like I can decide one day I'm going to be just a colleague and nothing else. I am a colleague perhaps in this particular moment when I'm at work and I'm interacting with other people, but I'm at the same time also a husband, a father, a friend, etc., etc. And the idea here is that I need to conserve my both physical and emotional, mental energy so that I can do my best in all of these roles. Whenever it is that I need to do something about it. If I'm going to waste a lot of energy and time on a particular thing, especially that something that is for which my efforts are in fact not efficacious, then I'm really trading off with everything else. I am getting depressed, let's say, by just constantly reading the news about things that are not actionable, about things that I cannot do anything about. Well, the result of that is then I'm not useful to my family. I'm not useful to my friends. I'm not, in fact, useful to society in general, and even to myself. So it's about conserving energy, setting priorities. This goes back to the first discipline of Epictetus, the discipline of desire, setting goals. Depending on our values, we set goals and we set priorities. And doing so is crucial, because otherwise we end up wasting a lot of time and then regretting it. And usually when you get to the point of regret, especially near the end of your life, it's a little too late. Seneca points out in one of his letters to his friend Lucilius that too many people start reflecting on what they want to do and why near the end of their lives, when it's too late, when they've already done most of what they were going to do. Stoicism is one of the Greco-Roman philosophies that evolved during the Hellenistic period. And the goal is to live a eudaimonic life. Eudaimonia is a word that in Greek means, roughly speaking, a life worth living. The kind of life that you get to the end of it and you say, yeah, that was not wasted time. Now, different Hellenistic schools, like the Epicureans, for instance, or the Skeptics, had different answers to what constitutes a eudaimonic life. According to the Stoics, living a eudaimonic life means living intelligently, smartly, and socially. Because one of the fundamental aspects of Stoicism is that we should live a pro-social life, that is, a life where we interact with other people because we are naturally a social organism, then the Stoics put a lot of emphasis on relationships with people, on our roles in society. What is it that is a good thing or not thing to do with respect to other people? In fact, they went so far as declaring themselves cosmopolitan. Being a cosmopolitan means being a member of the human cosmopolis, the human city, the universal human city. According to the Stoics, every human being on earth is our brother and sister, and we should treat them accordingly. The ancient Stoic Epictetus, who lived at the beginning of the second century, laid out three fundamental disciplines for the study and practice of Stoicism. They're referred to normally as the discipline of desire, the discipline of action, and the discipline of assent, although I should warn you that the English terms are a little bit misleading compared to the original Greek. Desire, for instance, doesn't mean whatever I fancy at the moment. It means my values, and also my disvalues, that is, the kinds of things that I think are important and good in life, and the kind of things that are not important or bad in life. The discipline of desire teaches us to reevaluate critically our values, to reorient ourselves according to good values, to make deliberate decisions about what those values are and why. The second discipline, the discipline of action, has to do, as the name implies, with acting toward other people. We live in a society. We don't just subscribe to certain values. We enact those values every time that we do something or say something, especially to other people. So the discipline of action is about putting into practice our values when we interact in society at large with other human beings. Finally, the discipline of assent. Assent means, of course, agreement. But for Epictetus, that means thinking carefully and rationally about the other two disciplines, about values and how to implement them. So the discipline of assent, in a sense, is about making all of this flow so nicely and so smoothly that we have, in fact, according to the Stoics, a smoothly flowing life. The three disciplines are a way to implement Stoicism in practice. But Stoicism, of course, is a philosophy, so there is also a theory behind it. And in order to understand the Stoic theory, we need to refer to the three areas of study that were typical in any Stoic curriculum. If you went to...
Ipapatso ya go rekisiwa ga mmu wa tlhakanelo. Re etsang banne ba mafelo a batho botlhe ba ba nnang mo gone mo Namibia. Seno ke kitsiso e e botlhokwa thata go tswa lefapeng la temothuo, ditlhapi, metsi le tlhabololo ya mmu. Tsweetswe, re etsa ka kelotlhoko mme lo bolele ba lolapa la lona, baagisani le ditsala ka molaetsa ona. Tlogela go reka gongwe go rekisa mmu wa morafe ka ntlha ya eng, ka gonne mmu o leng wa batho botlhe ba Namibia ke mmu wa puso, mme o ka se rekisiwe ka tsela epe. Go nna le seabe mo dipuisanong dip tse di amanang go rekisa gongwe go reka ga o ka fa molaong gotlhelele. Molao wa Communal Land Reform Act, molao wa botlhano wa ngwaga 2022, o thibela ditiro tse di ntseng jalo ka tlhamalalo. Ditlamorago tsa ditherisano tse di seng ka fa molaong tsa lefatshe, dikotlhao tsa semolao. Ba ba tlolang molao ba ka duedisiwa madi kgotsa ba tsenngwa mo kgolegelong. Go kgoreletsa kutlwano ya setšhaba, go rekisa kgotsa go reka mmu wa setšhaba go ka baka dikgotlang tsa lefatshe le dikgotlang mo setšhabeng sa rona. Se o tlhokang go se itse, lefatshe la morafe ke la rona rotlhe. Ke thoto e abelanwang e tshwanetseng go sologela molemo mongwe le mongwe. Sireletsa boswa jwa rona ka go tlotla lefatshe la rona, ka go tlotla boswa lengwe ya rona le go sireletsa tikologo ya rona. Go bega ditiro tse di seng ka fa molaong. Fa e le gore o belaela gore go na le kgwebo e e seng ka fa molaong ya lefatshe, tsweetswe, begela bolaodi jwa ditso lekgotla la mmu la bommasepala kgotsa na ofisi ya lefapha e e gaufi le wena. A re direng mmogo go sireletsa lefatshe la rona le re le abelanang gore dikokomana tse di tlang di le dirise. Lefapha le ka se ikarabele mo tatlhegelong ya lefatshe ka ntlha ya go rekisiwa ga lefatshe la morafe go go seng ka fa molaong. Gakologelwa, lefatshe la morafe le botlhokwa fela thata. A re le bolokeleng, le babalesegile ebile le sireletsegile mo go botlhe. Ke lebogela tirisano mmogo ya lona. Molaetsa wa radio o gasiwa go ya ka thuso ya madi go tswa pusong ya Namibia le Federal Republic of Germany go ya ka tirisano mmogo ya German Development Bank. Go bona tshedimosetso ka botlalo, tsweetswe, ikgolaganye le ofisi ya lefapha e e gaufi le lefelo la lona kgotsa ofisi ya dikitsiso tsa setšhaba ya lefapha la temothuo, ditlhapi, metsi le tlhabololo ya lefatshe mo nomoreng ya 061 208 7604.
Lipura nengeno wapumbwa eva tere ulikoni maondu tuto ingida ashike kapeno nwe kutite opoye ekukurile. Oshafa fana nongeshe faili mehola mo iho etike kovano ile koshiwana. Onongeshe fa ya pumbwa kukaraya kovano. Akupitira mo IGL FM otuna evi tota njuka akukwetira oipindi konu konda doili nawa. Nune udo otukwetira o special angetashake ngeshe fa omarudi dayo loka opone ushendife nawa nokumona oijamo ili nawa ninge kwata fanona monika ko IGL FM onora etatu imwe bali heali nola natu heali bali no heali ile konderewa nora etatu natu bali o etatu matatu oma filane IGL FM the eye.
A Stoic school, let's say the school that was run by Epictetus in northwestern Greece in the second century, you would actually study, before you get to the disciplines and how to live your life, you would study the three general areas that are pertinent to those disciplines. Now, there too, the English names are a little bit misleading. They are physics, ethics, and logic. But what they mean exactly is something a little bit different from modern English, and so we need to be careful here. Physics, for instance, comes from physis, which means nature. So when I say physics, don't think quantum mechanics or general relativity or things like that. Think science in general. So a good understanding of how the world works. That's connected to the discipline of desire, that is, to the discipline that deals with our goals and priorities in life. Why? Because our goals and priorities in life depend on what kind of living organism we are. If we were a different kind, you know, a Martian or a dog or a lion, we would have different priorities. So it's about understanding the world as it works. And the best way to understand the world as it is through science. So you study science in order to investigate into your own goals and priorities. These days, ethics means mostly the study of right and wrong actions. But for the Stoics or for the ancient Greco-Romans in general, ethics had, again, a much broader meaning. It meant literally the study of how to live your life. So it's not just about whether a particular action is right or wrong. It's also about your motivations for carrying out a particular action. Are they good motivations or not good motivations? Is about your priorities in life, your goals, the way you relate to other people, and so on and so forth. The second discipline of action is connected with ethics. Action is about dealing with other people. Ethics is about how to live a life. Since we're a social animal, the two are very closely related. We live a social life. We don't live on deserted islands. We don't do very well when we are on our own. We can survive perhaps on our own under certain circumstances, but we only thrive in a society. When I say logic, most people start thinking about logical puzzles and paradoxes and things like that. And that's fine. That is part of it. But logic, according to the Stoics, is in general the study of good thinking. So it includes also what we would today call cognitive science, the understanding of cognitive biases and the understanding of why people's thinking can go wrong one way or the other. So it's much broader than the technical field of logic. Assent. Assent is about refining our understanding and practice of the first two disciplines. In other words, it's about using good judgment. And therefore, it's about logic. It's about understanding how human reasoning works and also how it can go wrong so that we avoid as much as possible mistakes and we try to think as much as we can in a rational, reasonable way and then implement that kind of approach into daily life. One of the obvious questions that come up with Stoicism is, does it work? Which, if you think about it, on the one hand, it's a little bit of a weird question because we're talking about a philosophy. We're not talking about, you know, a scientific approach to life as we understand it today. Very few people, for instance, would ask the question, well, does Christianity work or does Buddhism work? However, they might ask, do prayers work? Or does meditation work? In other words, the techniques associated with certain religions or philosophies. In those cases, it does make sense to ask yourself, well, does it work? Is it something that quite independently of the theoretical part of the philosophy, does it actually have empirical evidence? So the same question can be asked reasonably about Stoicism. We have a series of lines of evidence that Stoic techniques, the Stoic approach to a good life, does in fact work. The first one is that Stoicism originated what is now known as cognitive behavioral therapy back in the 1960s. In New York, authors like Aaron Beck and Albert Ellis started to practice this type of psychotherapy, which today is one of the best evidence-based type of psychotherapies. And they started from Stoicism. They both read Marcus Aurelius, Epictetus, and other Stoics, and they thought, oh, these people were onto something here. There's something that can work, that is very practical, that can actually help people. Of course, CBT, as is known today, went then through a series of changes and evolution over the last several decades. CBT is empirically based. There is lots of studies, empirical studies, that show that it does work. So it's not the same as asking whether Stoicism worked, but it's pretty close to asking whether Stoic techniques work, because a lot of the techniques that the ancient Stoics designed and developed on the basis of their intuition about human psychology and human nature, turns out, are actually efficacious. So that's one line of evidence that Stoicism, in a sense, works. There's also an increasing number of papers out there on cognitive science in general, not just cognitive behavioral therapy, but cognitive science in general, how the brain works, how human decision-making is carried out, and so on and so forth. And my understanding is that much of that research is, if not in direct support of Stoic techniques, it certainly is compatible, highly compatible with it. For instance, modern psychologists and cognitive scientists have developed a theory of the relationship between reason and emotions that is very similar to the way in which the Stoics were thinking about the connection between reason and emotion. And then finally, there now begins to be direct studies about the efficacy of Stoic techniques. Stoicism is popular enough that psychologists have begun to look into systematically into whether specifically Stoic techniques work or don't. For instance, one of my colleagues, Tim LeBon, who is a psychotherapist, has just published recently one of the first papers that shows at least preliminary evidence that, yes, indeed, Stoic techniques seem to have the kind of effects on behavior and on the way people think that the Stoics thought they should have. Stoicism is a philosophy of life. And that, if you think about it, it's an interesting concept. What is a philosophy of life in the first place? Do we need a philosophy of life? I encounter people that tell me that they don't need a philosophy of life. They just live their life. And I point out that that is a philosophy of life. There is no way to live a life without a philosophy. That philosophy might not be conscious. It may not be the result of deliberations that you did with yourself, you know, paying attention to what you're doing and why. But if I observe your behavior, if I see what your choices are, your priorities, your values, and so on and so forth, I can put them all together and say, okay, this person's philosophy of life is this. It's the result of, or it's whatever underpins their choices, their values, their priorities, and their behavior. So we all have a philosophy of life. If that's true, well, we might as well then be conscious of it and be aware of it and possibly even occasionally at least ask ourselves, well, is this a good philosophy of life or not? Do I need to change something? So one might be tempted then to go to the opposite extreme and say, oh, if I need a philosophy of life, I'm going to pick one off the shelf. Here's Stoicism. I heard that it's a good thing. Let me pick Stoicism. From now on, I'm a Stoic, and that's it. End of the story. But that is also dangerous in a sense, because now you're blindly following what somebody said 2,000 years ago or 2,300 years ago without necessarily thinking things through, without saying, asking yourself, well, does this thing actually make sense? Does it fit the way I want to live my life? And if not, why not? So there is, on the one hand, a danger of not being aware of one's own philosophy of life. There's also the opposite danger of sort of taking something off the shelf without questioning, without exercising one's own critical judgment about whether that thing actually makes sense, is useful, works, etc. Well, then there is a third option. Some people say, I'm going to build my own philosophy of life out of bits and pieces from different sources. So I heard that Stoicism is useful. I'm going to take something from Stoicism. I heard that Epicureanism is useful. I'm going to take something from that. Some of my friends are Buddhists. Perhaps I could borrow something from Buddhists. That is certainly something that can be done. It's usually referred to as eclecticism. But it's also got its own problems, because you might end up with a mishmash of things that don't make any sense when they're brought together. There is a reason why these philosophies are internally coherent and people have worked on them for thousands of years in order to make them internally coherent. For instance, although the Stoics themselves acknowledged that there is something useful in Epicureanism, and they actually incorporated aspects of Epicureanism into their philosophy, at the end of the day, one cannot be simultaneously a Stoic and an Epicurean. Why not? Because the most important value for a Stoic is one's own virtue, meaning one's own character. Pleasure is secondary. The most important value for an Epicurean is pleasure. One's character, one's virtues are actually only instrumental to a life of pleasure. So at the end of the day, there may be situations where you have to choose. Is it going to be pleasure or is it going to be character? And if you choose one way, you're an Epicurean. If you choose another way, you're a Stoic, whether you're aware of it or not. In my own case, I think of myself as mostly a Stoic, meaning that there are a number of things that in Stoic philosophy as a whole that I think are very valuable. They're very well thought out, and I have adopted them as at least a provisional way of navigating my own life. But I am also very much attracted by another ancient Greco-Roman philosophy, skepticism, which has to do with the notion that we're fallible. We don't know the truth with a capital T. At best, we can make reasonable guesses, probabilistic guesses about what works or what doesn't work, what is true and what is not true. And we should therefore always be aware that no matter what we do, we may be mistaken. No matter what we think, we might be mistaken. So I temper my stoicism with a little bit of skepticism. And in fact, I temper my Stoic skepticism with a little bit of something that it's called philosophical pessimism. This is the notion that there are probably no grand narratives in the world. There is no universal plan. There is no end to history. There is no inevitable trajectory that we go either in our lives or as a society as a whole. It's all about things happening here and now, and there is no rhyme or reason to them. So I put all these things together into what to me feels like a reasonably coherent philosophy. It's not my invention, and yet at the same time, it's not exactly anything that you find specifically in any particular other author. One thing that I would suggest, for instance, is certainly read the original texts. But even that is not that simple, because there are countless translations. And sometimes if you read the same book in different translations, it almost feels like a different book. There are versions of Marcus Aurelius's Meditations that really feel like a different book from some other translations. So one needs to be careful. The more recent translations, the more modern translations are better. Some of my favorite, for instance, are by a classicist named Robin Waterfield, who has translated both Marcus Aurelius and Epictetus. The University of Chicago Press has made a huge edition of all of the writings of Seneca. Invest a little bit of money. After all, if we're talking about something that you want to pursue as a philosophy of life, it's worth investing a few bucks to actually get it right or as right as possible. One of the advantages of these modern editions is that they have a lot of notes, and the notes will help you, will guide you through understanding what exactly these people are saying, because they're putting those notions in their philosophical as well as historical context. But the other thing is, I hear often people say, I'm just going to read the Stoic text, forget all of these modern authors, including yours truly, who are writing about Stoicism. I think that's a mistake. I mean, that may come across as a self-serving mistake, since, as I said, I'm one of those authors. But nevertheless, I think it is a mistake. I myself took advantage of the writings of modern authors. Because, again, Stoicism is ancient. It's 2300, almost 2400 years old. It needs interpretation. It needs updates. And that interpretation, those updates need to be done carefully by people who actually know what they're talking about. So, for instance, I would pick up a book by my friends and colleagues, Donald Robertson. Robertson is a cognitive behavioral therapist. That's his approach to Stoicism. Bill Irvine is a classicist, and so is John Sellers. Those are some of the best modern Stoic authors that you can trust. These are people who actually know what they're talking about. And all of these authors have written very, very accessible books that can be used to dig deeper into Stoicism as a modern philosophy of life.
Chapter 2, The Stoic Toolkit.
I'm going to try to teach you a few basic Stoic techniques that hopefully are going to make your life better in the long run, maybe even in the very short run, because a lot of Stoic techniques tend to be efficacious almost immediately. You can see the difference yourself after a few days or a few weeks of practice. And perhaps there is no better way to start than with the connection between reason and emotions. How do we deal with emotions? Emotions are a big part, of course, of the human experience. They are inevitable. Even if we wanted to avoid them, we cannot. They are an intrinsic part of our biology and our psychology. Sometimes they're useful. They are alarm bells, for instance. They alert us to certain things going right or going wrong. Sometimes they deceive us. And they create problems. They push us to react in ways that then we're later going to regret. The Stoics thought quite a bit about emotions. All of the major Stoic authors write about emotions, perhaps none more than Seneca, who was a Roman senator who lived in the first century. He wrote one of the best books on emotions, I think, ever written. It's called On Anger. And it focuses on that particular emotion because it's important. We all experience anger under different conditions. We all react in a way that is driven by anger, and sometimes we regret the way we have acted. So let's try to understand what the Stoics actually say about this. The fundamental idea is that emotions are not in fact distinct or sharply distinct from reason. A lot of people seem to think that reason is one thing and emotion is another thing, and they are sometimes in conflict with each other. So reason might have to overcome emotions, or perhaps if you are a so-called emotional person, you actually prefer the other way around. But in reality, the two are actually highly interconnected. And this is one insight, one intuition of the ancient Stoics that is definitely confirmed by modern cognitive science. We do know that the anatomical area from where human emotions, many human emotions originate is the amygdala, which is the base of the brain. And we do know that our reasoning faculty resides mostly in the frontal parietal lobes of the brain. But we also know that those two areas are massively interconnected. There are literally billions of neuronal fibers that go back and forth between the two, so that there is no such a thing as an emotional response independent of the way you think. And there is no such a thing as thinking independently of your emotional reactions. Well, if that's true, the Stoics say, there is your key to a better relationship with your emotions. What you need to do is a 2 or 3 step process that begins with cognition. It begins with thinking carefully before you get into any situation that might be emotionally complex about what you want to do and why. Once you set the stage in terms of thinking, then you try to behave accordingly to that particular way of thinking. If you think that one thing is right or wrong, then presumably you will want to behave according to that judgment. And it's this combination of cognition and behavior repeated over and over and over that eventually affects your emotions, sinks in at the emotional level, and in fact will alter your emotions. Let me give you an example. Let's say that somebody insults you. Epictetus talks a lot in his writings about insults and ways to deal with insults. And most of us would get upset at an insult, and in fact would probably react. We start escalating things. You feel that rush of adrenaline. You're getting angry. How dare this person talk to me in this way? And then you start raising your voice, and then it escalates into a confrontation, possibly even a physical confrontation. The Stoics would say, well, before all of that, think about it this way. What exactly is an insult? An insult is somebody opening their mouth, saying certain words. Those words arrive to your ears. You interpret them in a certain way. And because of that interpretation, you react. In other words, it's your thinking, it's your cognition that is the first step. If you think, this is unacceptable, this is an insult, how dare the person talk to me like that, then your emotions will follow. Then you're now fueling your anger. You're fueling your aggressive reaction to those words. But if instead of going that way, you say to yourself, an insult is nothing. It's just air moving around. It doesn't actually touch me. It doesn't actually do anything to me. If that person is saying something that about me that is insulting, what does that mean? Well, either that person is right, and maybe he's expressing his opinion in a clumsy way, but he's actually right, in which case, why am I going to be upset about it? If somebody is right and it's setting me right, then it's a good thing for me to accept that counsel, to accept that observation and do something about it. Or the person in question is wrong, in which case, that's his problem, not mine. I'm not the one in wrong. He is the one that is wrong. He should be concerned with it, not I. So either way, it is in my power not to react, because it is in my power to reframe the situation to myself and think, this is not an insult. This is just air bouncing off, and it doesn't actually touch me. It doesn't actually hurt me. Once you do that, you're now de-escalating your emotional response, because your emotions will react, will go along with whatever way you're thinking about the situation. If you're thinking that you've been offended, your emotions will escalate. If you're thinking that, oh, this is funny, this is really ridiculous, doesn't the person in question know that he's embarrassing himself, then your emotions will go in a different direction. It will de-escalate. You're not going to get angry. Now, this is, of course, easier said than done. This is not going to happen on your first try. But the key here is to constantly ask yourself, what exactly is going on here, and what is a good reaction? What might be a good reaction to what is going on? Once you reframe the whatever is happening to yourself that way, your emotions eventually will follow. The problem in dealing with situations as they are happening is that often we're not mentally prepared. And so we react in the moment, and then perhaps we misjudge the situation, our emotions start running away from us, and then we regret later on whatever we did or whatever we said. So the Stoics have a very important technique to help us prepare ourselves to difficult situations, to deal with difficult situations. That technique goes under a number of names. Often it's referred to as philosophical journaling. And I say philosophical because it's a particular type of journaling. This is not a diary where you just write down, oh, today I went and did this or did that, and it was fun, that sort of stuff. It's a journal of reflection. And perhaps the best model of that journal available to Stoic practitioners is the Meditations of the Emperor Marcus Aurelius. The Meditations was never meant for publication, is in fact the emperor's personal philosophical journal. And if you read it, you'll see there is no particular structure. There are 12 chapters. But the 12 chapters don't have any particular subheadings. There is no particular topic, because Marcus is going through his life and he's reflecting on whatever was happening at that moment and how he was reacting to what was happening. And so often people read the Meditations, for instance, and they come across with this notion that it's repetitive and it's a little preachy. Both of those things are true. It's repetitive because Marcus, just like the rest of us, kept running into the same problems over and over again. So, for instance, he had an issue with anger management. And so you will see in the Meditations that there are several places where Marcus says to himself, why did you get upset about this today? What is a better way to answer that situation, to react to that situation instead of getting angry? And it's preachy because he's preaching to himself. He's not talking to an audience. He's talking to himself, and he says, look, you really need to do things this way and not that way. So how does that work in practice? There is, incidentally, this is another thing where there is very good evidence from modern cognitive behavioral therapy in particular, but also cognitive science in general, that this technique of philosophical journaling, of reflection on your actions, actually does work. It's a very good tool for self-improvement, for ethical self-improvement. There are different ways in which you can do philosophical journaling. Both Seneca and Epictetus actually give you details. They there are bits in their writings where they say, this is how you do it. And as I said, Marcus Aurelius is a great example. There is a whole book there where you can read it and see how it is done. My favorite way of doing it is carving out a little bit of time at the end of the day, before you go to bed, when you're not too tired. Quiet down, open up your journal or your tablet or however you prefer to do it. This doesn't have to be a written exercise either. You can just think about it. But a it's better to be done as a written exercise, because then you have a record of what you've been doing and thinking over eventually a period of years, and then you can go back and check if we have improved in certain areas, or if there are certain issues that are particularly problematic and recurring for you. And you ask yourself, you pick a particular example of something that happened during the day. For instance, let's say somebody came up to me and trying to insult me, and he said something that is, you know, rude or uncalled for, and I reacted in a certain way. So I describe to myself in the journal the situation as objectively as I can, without using emotional language, as analytically as I can, because the point is not to relive the experience. The point is to analyze the experience and learn from it. In fact, if you notice, Marcus Aurelius writes his journal in the second person. He says, you did this and you reacted this way. This may sound strange and it may feel a little awkward to do it that way. But again, there is very good evidence from modern studies that it does help keeping the distance from your emotional responses, which is in fact helpful in trying to learn analytically from what you did and what you perhaps didn't do. Imagine you're just talking to a friend. You're writing to a friend. You say, you did this. How come you reacted this way or that way? So you pick a particular instance, something that happened, an incident that happened during the day. You briefly describe that incident to your friend. And then you ask yourself three questions. What did I do wrong? What did I do right? And what could I do next time? Why ask yourself those questions? The first one, what did I do wrong? The point is not to indulge in sort of regret and self-flagellation and things like that. Those are all useless according to the Stoics. Whatever you did, it's done. You cannot change it. You cannot go back in time and change it. However, you can learn from it. The second question is, well, what did I do right? It's essentially the same idea, only in the flip side of that coin. That is, you don't just want to remind yourself the kinds of things that you do wrong. You also want to set goals that you're going to achieve over and over. Here's where I don't want to go the next time. Here's where I do want to go the next time. Or here's what I want to do less and less moving forward. And here's what I want to do more and more moving forward. The third question is arguably the most crucial one. What could I have done differently? Again, this is not about regret, because you can't change what you did. But it's about the fact that, you know, as much as we think of our lives as endlessly fascinating and different and varied and all that sort of stuff, in fact, most of the times we tend to do the same things pretty much every day. That's an advantage as far as the Stoics are concerned, because what that means is that whatever situation you did not handle properly today is likely going to happen again, possibly soon. So if a colleague, for instance, came in and said something insulting or rude or whatever, well, you know, that person isn't going to go away very likely anytime soon. So, and his behavior is not going to change necessarily in any radical fashion. So you can expect reasonably then in a few days or next week or next month, something close to that will happen again. But now you're ready. You may not have been ready today when it happened. That's why you're doing this self-analysis in your philosophical journal, but you're going to be ready next time. You're telling yourself, okay, well, if this happens again, here is a better way to respond. That way you're prepared. And Seneca says a prepared mind handles difficulties, handles difficult, delicate situations much better. Perhaps not perfectly. The goal is not perfection necessarily, but better. You may have heard of something called the Serenity Prayer, which is not exactly the same thing that comes to mind when we talk about Stoicism, but bear with me for a second, there is a connection. The Serenity Prayer, which is often recited at the beginning of meetings of 12-step organizations, such as Alcoholic Anonymous, goes something like this. It asks God to have the wisdom to tell the difference between what we can change and what we cannot change, the courage to change what we can, and the serenity to accept what we cannot. That notion, that Serenity Prayer, was written at the beginning of the 20th century by an American theologian. But in fact, it's a rephrasing of a fundamental insight by the Stoic Epictetus that goes back to the beginning of the second century. The two are in fact connected historically, because it turns out that Epictetus's Manual for the Good Life was used throughout the Middle Ages by Christian monks as a source of spiritual exercises. Now, Epictetus doesn't quite phrase it that way, but the same idea holds, and it's one of the most interesting and most useful ideas in Stoicism. Epictetus talks about some things are up to us and some things are not up to us, and we should focus on the things that are up to us and act on them, because that is where our agency is efficacious, and we should develop an attitude of acceptance and equanimity toward the things that are not up to us. Now, we all live in a complex world where there are all sorts of things that we don't necessarily control, both at a macroscopic level, let's say political change, social change, things like that, and at a personal level, you know, things happen in our life that we don't necessarily have much to say or do about, because they depend on a number of factors that we do not control. So how do the Stoics deal with those kinds of uncertainties and that kind of limited agency that at the end of the day we all have? Let's pick an example, a specific example. Let's say that tomorrow morning I'm going to have a job interview, and it's a job that I really want. It's important for me to do well in that interview. Epictetus will say, well, the best way you can prepare yourself for that challenge is the day before, let's say, to ask yourself what under these circumstances is up to me and what is not up to me. And you can do this literally by making two lists. You can do it in your mind, or better yet, you can write down a table. You can draw a table with two columns and say up to me, not up to me. It's surprising once you start paying attention to the question how many things you actually will be able to list. For instance, actually getting the job, not up to me. It depends on the competition. It depends on who's doing the interview and how they're feeling that day, and on a number of other things that are really not under my control, which means, according to Epictetus, that I have to be ready to accept the possibility that things will not go my way, and accept that with serenity, with equanimity, because that's the way the world works. Sometimes job interviews are successful and other times they're not. And we are adults. We don't throw a tantrum when things don't go our way. What is up to me? Well, clearly to prepare myself as much as possible and as carefully as possible for the job interview. What else is up to me? Well, try to get a good night's sleep, because we know that being rested and all that helps. But notice that I said to try to get a good night's sleep, not to actually get a good night's sleep, because it's possible that my neighbor in the next apartment is throwing a party into the late night, and I will not be able to sleep as many hours as I should or want to, because there are, again, circumstances that are outside of my control that are going to interfere with it, with my intentions. So the intention is good, is mine, but the outcome is not under my control. What else? Well, it's certainly a good idea to show up on time for the job interview. That means that you care, that you are a professional, and so on and so forth. But again, there, what is up to me is to try to show up on time. I live in New York. That's not a guarantee. I can get on the subway, and the subway all of a sudden stops in the middle of the tracks, and it's not going to move. Or I may take a taxi, and there's a lot of traffic, and I may actually get there late. So to try to have the intentions, do my best in order to get there on time is up to me. Actually getting there on time is not up to me. And so on and so forth. So we can come up with these lists that are actually fairly detailed. The more detailed, the better. And the idea is that once you have these lists of things that are up to me and things that are not up to me, you focus only on the one to the left side. The things that are up to me. Those are the ones that I want to rehearse, think carefully about, be as prepared as possible, because my agency lies in that direction. All of the other ones, I can still be aware of them, and I can mentally prepare myself for the possibility that they are or they're not going to go in my preferred direction, but that's all I can do about it. The result is that you're much more efficacious in the things you do, because your agency is in fact at play there. But it's also true that you accept things in a way that maintains calm, tranquility, serenity. You don't upset yourself over things for which, frankly, there is no point in getting upset. The same approach of focusing on things that are up to us and accepting with equanimity things that are not up to us can be applied to pretty much every situation and every challenge or potential setback we might suffer. not just at an individual level, at a personal level, but also at a societal level or a political level. And the Stoics themselves lived in really turbulent times. The Hellenistic period, which went from the death of Alexander the Great and the collapse of the Macedonian Empire to the Battle of Actium in 31 BCE, which basically marked the beginning of the Roman Empire, was in fact a period of major turmoil where things were changing very rapidly, seemingly completely outside the control of most individuals. Well, we might live in a similar situation. We're facing major challenges that all of us, most of us, feel unprepared and not particularly able to do anything about. You know, there's political change, there's social change. We're facing the possibility of climate catastrophe. We are still facing the possibility of, you know, nuclear war, for instance, and things like that. How does a Stoic deal with those kinds of situations? It's exactly the same approach. Again, you ask yourself, what here is up to me and what is not up to me? You make the two lists, you focus on the first one, and then you try to do your best to accept with serenity the second. For instance, let's say that I'm concerned about climate change, as I should be. Well, I can't change anything dramatically at that level for that kind of problem on my own. And this is not an individual level. Arguably, it's not even a problem that can be solved by an individual society. It requires literally global actions. But that doesn't mean that I cannot do anything about it. So if I start writing down the things that are up to me, I can come up, for instance, with the following partial list. Well, I can inform myself that the first basis for rational decisions is to get informed. I can also donate to organizations that actively work in that direction. I can vote. I can talk to people. I can go in the streets and join other people that are vocal about these kind of things. All of these approaches are in fact up to me. They're under my agency. And doing them by themselves, of course, will not solve the problem, but it will contribute toward the solution of the problem. And just as importantly, at a personal level, will make me feel better because I'm doing something about it. But by the same token, there's the second column, the things that are not up to me. Actually solving the problem of climate change is certainly not up to me. Actually even getting a particular politician that might contribute to the solution elected is not up to me. Actually achieving, in fact, all of those things that I just mentioned is not really up to me. And therefore, although I hope that things are going to go in a certain direction, I have to be ready for the possibility that they won't. And that's okay, because again, not everything in life goes the way we prefer, and we need to accept as rational, reasonable adults that we may not have a choice. And we need to be okay with the notion that we don't have a choice on everything. We cannot act on everything. We cannot solve everything. I'm sure you notice that one of the things in life is that sometimes we have to make tough decisions and we second guess ourselves. We tend to go one way and then think maybe I should have gone the other way. We tend to think in a dichotomous fashion. We tend to think that it's either black or white, either this or that. The Stoics thought a lot about decision making. In fact, Epictetus thought that our most important faculty was something that he called prohairesis, which is Greek for will. The decision, the ability to actually arrive at a judgment, at an assessment of a situation, and then try to act on it, do your best to act on it. The problem is, of course, that life sometimes is complicated. There are multiple choices. We have a tendency to want to simplify things and go for something that is stark, that it's clear, that it's obvious. That's just not the way the world works. And according to the Stoics, it's much better to try to understand how the world works and then act accordingly rather than trying to impose on the world the way we want to think or the way we prefer things to be. There are several passages in Epictetus' discourses where he talks to his students and he reminds them this is to design the world in a certain way that it's convenient for you. It's not up to you. At one point, in fact, it gets even pretty funny. One of the students apparently complained of having a cold and a running nose. And Epictetus looks at him and says, "So, what do you think? The universe should rearrange yourself so that you don't have a running nose? Why don't you just get a handkerchief and wipe it off?" So sometimes it's about obvious things. Sometimes it's about things that are complicated. And There is no sure way to make right decisions. The only thing that we can do is to make sure that we fine-tune as much as possible our prohairesis, that is our faculty of judgment. That is what the third discipline of Epictetus is about, right? The discipline of assent. Assent means to agree to something. According to the Stoics, we are constantly bombarded by impressions, what they call impressions. An impression is essentially a combination of a sensorial experience and an immediate, usually instinctive judgment. For instance, I might walk down the street and I have the impression that it's good to go by and eat that gelato that I just saw displayed because it tastes good, it looks good, it's attractive, I should do it. That's an impression. It's a combination of I am seeing something and I'm immediately arriving at a judgment that doing something about that object is a good thing. Epictetus says that that's the time when you want to stop and think. Ask yourself, in fact, talk to your impression. Say, well, wait a minute. Is this really a good thing? Should I actually go and on and get the gelato and eat it right now? Well, maybe not, because I'm on my way to dinner. Eating a gelato would spoil my appetite. Also, frankly, my waistline is not exactly in the best shape possible, so that's not going to help either. No, on second thought, a better decision is to ignore the gelato, keep walking, and go home. That's a simple situation, but we face constantly these kinds of decision-making opportunities, so to speak. And we also constantly second guess ourselves. Oh man, I should have done this. I should have done these other things. The Stoics think that what is up to you is your intentions, not the outcomes of those intentions. So what you need to do is to work on why are you trying to do certain things more than on will I succeed in doing these things? And that might simplify our decision-making problems. For instance, let's say that, I go and volunteer at my soup kitchen around the corner from my apartment. Is this a good thing to do or is not a good thing to do? Well, most people probably would say that it's a good thing because I'm helping other people. I'm spending my time in a way that it's helpful to others and so on and so forth. But a Stoic would actually frame the question differently. The question would be not necessarily is the action itself good or not, but are your motivations virtues or not? Why am I doing this? If it turns out that I genuinely want to help people, then that is in fact a virtuous action, whether I succeed or not. However, it's also possible that I decided to do that because I need a new line on my resume to look good the next time that I apply for a job so that I can show that I also volunteer for social causes. Well, that's not virtuous. Because now I'm using other people as a means to an end, to my own end, to self-aggrandize, to get my own benefit out of this thing, right? So it's not virtuous. Even though it might still be useful to others, I might still be helpful to others. This is not really the right thing to do because it actually undermines my character. So to shift perspective from the outcome, is this a good thing or a bad thing, to my intentions and therefore my character. Is this good for me? Does this make me a better person? Or does it actually undermine my character? It makes me a worse person. Very often we'll simplify our decision making because it turns out that the answer to why am I doing this is often much simpler than the answer to is this really truly a good thing to do or not a good thing to do. The very goal of Stoic philosophy, of Stoicism, is to make us into better human beings, into the kind of human beings that lives a life that is worth living. But what does that mean in practice? Well, it means a number of things, but one way in which the Stoics answered that question, you know, what sort of life we should live, is that they say we should live according to nature. Now, to live according to nature doesn't mean running naked into the forest and hugging trees, although, of course, there's nothing wrong with that necessarily. It means to look at the kind of living being or organism that a human is and what actually makes that organism flourish, makes it do good things, better things, have a happier life as opposed to the kinds of things that get in the way of human flourishing. This turns ethics, remember that for the Stoics, ethics is the study of how to live a good life, into essentially an empirical discipline, because it's about human nature. You have to observe things about what makes human beings better or worse, what makes a human life better or worse. The Stoics drew an interesting analogy. They thought that ethics is like medicine. You know, medicine, of course, being concerned with the body, ethics being concerned with the mind, with our psyche. Now, there are some things, some behaviors that are natural for us, but they're not good from a medical perspective. For instance, we have a natural attraction to sugar and to fatty foods. That probably evolved by natural selection in a period of human evolution where there wasn't a lot of food around. And so every time that we run into a source of fat or sugar, we were better served by actually taking advantage of it, right? But we don't live in that kind of environment anymore. We don't live in the Pleistocene anymore. We live in cities where you can find food 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And so having these natural craving, because it's natural, for fat and sugar, it's actually not good for us. It undermines our physical health. It causes all sorts of problems, diabetes and so on, heart attacks, etc. So a doctor will look at this and say, look, this is in fact a natural craving, but the healthy thing to do would be to resist that craving, to reorient your priorities elsewhere. The Stoics make exactly the same argument in terms of the human psyche. There are some things that are natural to human beings, that come natural to human beings in terms of behavior. For instance, anger. Anger is a natural response to a perceived injustice. But the Stoics argue anger is the psychological equivalent of a fatty food or a lot of sugar. It's just not good for you mentally. It doesn't lead to a good life. Then what is good for you at a mental level, at a psychical level? Two things. To reason your way through your problems instead of bulldozing things or just reacting in the moment. And most importantly, to be social, to cooperate with other people. Because we are, of course, social animals and we thrive in a society, in a social group. Now, from there, the step is not very far to realizing that it's not just my immediate group, it's not just my family, my friends, or perhaps the people that live in my city. It makes sense to cooperate, to be good, to be positive about any human being that lives anywhere, because after all, we live in an interconnected world. Now, one of those early Stoics, a guy named Hierocles, in the second century wrote a book called Principles of Ethics. Hierocles says, what we should try to do is to metaphorically bring people, all the people, closer and closer to us. Imagine that you are the center of your own world. As soon as you do that, you immediately realize that you depend on other people, your parents, for instance, your siblings. And then eventually you realize that you depend on other people that you start calling your friends. And then you depend on further larger group of people outside, you know, acquaintances or people that you don't necessarily directly come in contact with, but that indirectly affect your life. Well, what Hierocles said was what you need to do is to bring all those circles, which extend eventually all the way to the entirety of humanity, closer and closer to yourself. You should think of your friends as if they were your family. You should think of your acquaintances as if they were your friends. You should think of strangers as if they were your acquaintances, and so on and so forth. Bring them closer. Your circles of concern should shrink, and your concern should expand to all of these people. And Hierocles actually goes so far as giving practical advice of how to do that. This is not just a way of thinking about stuff. You actually can behave in a way that is cosmopolitan, because that's ultimately the word that the Stoics used. And the way you do that is, Hierocles says, just go around, and when you meet strangers, address them as brother and sister, or perhaps uncle and aunt, depending on their age and their gender and so on. In other words, remind yourself and others that we are, in fact, all on the same boat together and that we depend on each other for a good navigation. Now, at this point, you might be tempted to think, this is just too simple. Some things are up to me, other things are not up to me. Yeah, sure, everybody knows that. So what? How is that going to make a difference in my life? Well, but the issue is not that things are simple or not. The issue is, are you going to act on those things? Are you actually going to practice those things? Ethics, after all, is not rocket science. You're not going to have to build a rocket that goes to the moon. You just have to improve your life bit by bit, action by action, thought by thought. Here's an analogy that the Stoics themselves made very often with athletics. They thought, well, you know, if you go into a gym and somebody's going to show you, a trainer is going to show you how to lift weights, for instance, you might be tempted to say, oh, is that all there is to it? It's a simple action. I pick up the weights in a certain way. I make sure that my posture in a certain way, and then that's it. I'm done. Yes, the action is conceptually simple, but the difference is going to come only if every day or several times a week you come to the gym and you actually do that action. That's how you're going to get your muscles. That's how you're going to get your physical ability improved. Not by the fact that you understand something that is simple to do, but by the fact that once you understood it, you actually practice it over and over and over. The same goes for the kind of Stoic advice that we've heard so far. Yes, it's very simple to say that, you know, some things are up to me and other things are not up to me. What is difficult is to actually follow through. Every time that you face a challenge, every time that you face a difficult situation, you go through that exercise and then you focus your attention on what is up to you and trying to develop a good attitude of acceptance and equanimity toward that is not up to you. That is the difficult part. It's not the conceptual understanding, it's the actual practice. I did not start my life or my career as a Stoic or a Stoic practitioner. In fact, I was something quite different. I began my academic career as an evolutionary biologist. I've always been interested in science ever since I was a kid. I decided that biology was my passion, and I went through all of the steps, formal and otherwise, that eventually build a career in that field. But then, like many people, at some point I got to a moment of crisis. Call it a midlife crisis, if you will. So you get to a point where you say, well, this was fun. This was interesting. I've been doing this for, let's say, 20 years, 25 years. Do I really want to do this same thing for another 25, 30, or however much time I have? And my answer was no. I need to do something different. When I was back in high school in Rome, in Italy, I had a wonderful teacher of philosophy for 3 years who really made the field come alive, and it really developed a passion for philosophy in me. So when the crisis came, the answer was almost immediately obvious. It's like, oh, well, I need to go into philosophy then, because that is the other thing that I'm passionate about. So I went back to school and I got my degree, graduate degree in philosophy, and I switched career to philosophy of science. But you know, the midlife crisis was still going, and it wasn't concerned just with the academic career, just with the job aspect of things, right? A number of things happened more or less at the same time in my life. My father died, for instance. I knew that this was going to happen, but when it did happen, it hurt. It really hit very hard. I was hit by an unexpected divorce, for instance. I moved across country because of my career change. Now, any psychologist would tell you that one of those things is pretty stressful. If three or four happened, as they did to me in the span of a few months, that can actually trigger a crisis. That can make you really reconsider your priorities. And that is exactly what happened to me. So I thought, well, I'm studying philosophy. I'm becoming a professional philosopher. Philosophy means love of wisdom, literally. Surely, if there is an answer to my current predicament, surely if there are tools that will allow me to overcome these challenges and to move forward, they're going to come from philosophy. Yes, but where from philosophy? Which part of philosophy? Philosophy is a huge field. So I studied more or less systematically. I looked into Buddhism, for instance, because several friends told me that Buddhism was a good approach if you're looking for a philosophy of life. It didn't quite click, however. It didn't speak to me at a deep level as I was hoping and expecting. So eventually I figured out that the answer, whatever was going to be, was going to come from virtue ethics. Virtue ethics is the general Greco-Roman tradition that has to do with self-improvement understood as improvement of your character. But even that is a large field. We have Aristotle, we have Epicurus, we have all sorts of ancient authors, all of whom have something interesting to say, and I did read some of these, but again, nothing clicked. Then one day, I was scrolling on my phone on the thing that at the time was called Twitter, and now called X, and I saw a tweet that said, "Help us celebrate Stoic Week." And I thought, that's odd. Why would anybody want to celebrate the Stoics? Because, of course, I thought, like many people, of the Stoics as, you know, stiff upper lip and suppression of emotion kind of people, as sort of a Mr. Spock from Star Trek. But then I realized, I thought, wait a minute, hold on. The Stoics, that Stoicism also was a type of virtue ethics, so it was in the general ballpark of what I was already interested in pursuing. Then I remember one of the Stoics was Marcus Aurelius, and I read the Meditations when I was in college, and I found it an interesting, provocative book. I also remember that Seneca was another Stoic, and I translated Seneca from Latin when I was in high school. So I thought, okay, maybe there's something here that might be worth investigating. So I signed up for Stoic Week, which, by the way, is something that happens every year, usually in October or November. And in fact, now I'm on the board of the organization called Modern Stoicism that actually organizes Stoic Week. But at the time I signed up and I downloaded their guide and their material, their readings. And the first thing that I read was by a guy who I never heard of before named Epictetus. And one of his students said, you know, wouldn't it be good for me to become rich and powerful? That way I can help my family, my friends. I can even perhaps do something good for my country. And Epictetus' answers was interesting. He said, well, who is going to tell you what the right thing to do is for your family, for your friends, and for your country? The money or the power are not going to tell you. Your faculty of judgment is going to tell you, your prohairesis in Greek, your ability to think carefully and rationally about things, which is the very thing that Stoics tend to cultivate and try to improve throughout their lives. That did it. I almost heard the click at the back of my mind. I said, this is my guy. Epictetus talks in a way that is no nonsense. It's very clear what he says and what he means. He doesn't suffer fools easily. He has a sense of humor that borders onto sarcasm, perhaps, and that I respond to that kind of approach. And so I started devouring everything that I could possibly find by Epictetus and about Epictetus. And here we are now, a dozen years later, we're still talking about Stoicism. The decision to start studying and, most importantly, practicing Stoicism had an immediate effect on my life. Like in a matter of days, I was thinking about certain issues that had plagued me for a long time in a very different way, and I was beginning to act differently about those issues. For instance, ever since I was a kid, I struggled with weight. You know, it's never exactly what I wanted, or in fact, even close to what I wanted it. But, you know, as a biologist, I understand that weight is a complex matter. It depends on a large number of causes, some of which I can influence and some of which I don't. My genetic background and my early development are certainly not up to me. That means that there are limits to what I can do 40 years later, 50 years later about that particular problem. So I accept those limits. At the same time, however, there are things that I can do. I can and certainly do now eat a much more healthy diet. I go and exercise more often and so on and so forth. Those are things that are up to me. Now, these are not earth-shattering things, but the important difference is that they sunk inside me in a way that I never did before. It's not that I never heard before of exercise or healthy lifestyle or genetics. I'm a biologist after all. But I never really incorporated those things deep into my thinking, and therefore they were not reflected into my actions. Another thing that my friends and family noticed immediately was that I was getting much less angry and upset about things. I, just like Marcus Aurelius, I did have an anger problem. I was sometimes stupefied by how people can say or do certain things without considering the effect that they have on others. And I would get upset. I would get angry at the perceived injustice, either toward me or toward people I cared. But Stoicism made me realize that that's just the way the world works. That doesn't mean you cannot do anything about it. You can certainly talk to people about certain things. You can certainly reframe things in your own mind so that they will not upset you. But as Marcus Aurelius says, to expect that people are not going to do stupid things or that people are not going to say things that are hurtful is just to expect that the world is going to be completely different from the way it is. And if there is anything about the Stoics, is that they're very realistic about the world. They accept the world the way it actually is, not the way you would want it to be. Again, let's be clear here. This is not a counsel for being a doormat and just take whatever comes your way without reacting. Reactions, actions and reactions are important. It's the fabric of human life. But those actions and reactions need to be thought carefully so that they're most efficacious, and they need to be carried out in a way that is realistic. You do not expect miracles to happen because, unfortunately, that's not the way the world works.
Chapter 3, Debunking Misconceptions About Stoicism.
Perhaps predictably, there is a lot of discussion and even a little bit of confusion about what Stoicism is and is not. If you read a random writing about Stoicism, or you listen to a random podcast about Stoicism, you would hear things like, "Oh, don't go that way because that's not really Stoicism." It's the other. And in fact, to some extent, I've done this as well. I think I have arguments for it. These arguments, I think, are based on a good understanding of the philosophy as well as on the original texts. But I admit there are different opinions about the nature of Stoicism. This is not surprising. We see the same thing in other philosophies and religion. There are different opinions about what Christianity is. There are different opinions about what Buddhism is. And in fact, arguably, there are different Christianities and different Buddhisms, meaning that there are different ways to interpret what the ancient texts say, and also different ways to update those texts and those philosophies to the 21st century. So the same goes for Stoicism. In fact, to some extent, this has happened from the beginning. One of the students of Zeno of Sadium, who was the originator of Stoicism, he was the guy who actually started the Stoa, one of his students is on record disagreeing on some of the things that, about some of the things that Zeno was saying, and starting his own thing. He went in a different direction, and he started his own school. So this has happened since the beginning. Disagreement is the nature of philosophy and possibly the nature of the human condition. Nevertheless, one needs to be cautious about what we read and how we think about things, because we need to make at least a honest, concerted effort, if we're interested in a particular philosophy or religion, to get to the bottom of what the thing is actually about and not what necessarily some people claim it is about. Stoicism at the moment is in resurgence. It's very popular for a number of years now. You will easily find new books and new articles and new podcasts and new essays on Stoicism as a practical philosophy. And one might ask reasonably, why Stoicism all of a sudden? Well, on the one hand, Stoicism really never went away. It is true that all of the Hellenistic philosophies gradually disappeared from view between the 3rd and the 4th century, essentially contemporaneously with the rise of Christianity. And the two things are, in fact, more or less related. But it's also true that a lot of Stoic ideas were, in fact, incorporated into Christianity, and they were transmitted by the church, the early church fathers, into the Middle Ages. Eventually, they reemerged as Stoic ideas into the Renaissance and later on into the Enlightenment. And so the fact that today we are talking about Stoicism and people are practicing Stoicism isn't really that surprising. On the other hand, it is certainly the case that the number of people who are interested in Stoicism has surged dramatically over the last 10 to 15 years. And so it makes sense to ask ourselves, well, why? Possibly one of the answers is that we live in turbulent times, which are essentially the same kinds of times that led to the initial flourishing of Stoicism. Stoicism flourished during the Hellenistic period, which was a major period of lasting two or three centuries of political change, social change. In fact, all of the so-called Hellenistic philosophies, not just Stoicism, but also Epicureanism, two different forms of skepticism, and a number of others, were very popular and or arose at that time precisely because people were looking for answers. People were looking for ways to navigate a rapidly changing world that was difficult to make sense of and was even more difficult to cope with. Today, arguably, since I would say at least the 20th century and then certainly into the 21st century, we live in a similar world. Last century, we went through two world wars. Then we developed enough nuclear weapons to destroy the planet many times over. Then near the end of the 20th century and beginning of the 21st, we started being more aware of yet another major challenge, which we refer to as climate change. Not to mention, of course, more local at a national level or at a regional level, political change, social change, that keeps happening at a very high pace. And a lot of people are distraught by this. They don't know how to process this. They don't know what their place is going to be in a society that looks very different from not only the society of their parents and grandparents, but even the society that they experienced as younger selves. So it's no surprise that Stoicism in particular, which is a philosophy, after all, of resilience and of coping with potential challenges and potential drawbacks, is having a moment of resurgence. I think it's perfectly reasonable, and in fact, it's perfectly useful. However, that does bring people to a misunderstanding. A lot of people seem to think that that's all that Stoicism is. That is, that Stoicism is good only as a remedy toward setbacks and challenges. For instance, during the recent COVID pandemic, I personally got a lot of calls from people asking me about Stoicism and say, you know, can I use Stoicism to deal with the situation? And the answer was, of course you can. But you also don't want to forget that we make decisions all the time in life, throughout our lives, whether it's good times or bad times, whether it's a challenge or an opportunity, it doesn't matter. We still have to make the best decisions we can. And Stoicism, in a sense, is a philosophy about decision making, about the best way to approach decision making. So it's just as useful in good times, so to speak, as it is in bad times. It's just that people tend to reach for it only when they are in distress, and then they become sort of a little bit relaxed, probably inappropriately relaxed, I should say, when it comes to the good times. We don't think that if we are going through things that are positive, let's say we have a good moment in our career, or we come into some money or something like that, that those are problems. But in fact, they are problems because they also carry the necessity of decision making. If you came into some money, what are you going to do with that money? How are you going to invest it? How is that going to change your life for the better? The answer to those questions may not be that obvious. And so good decision making is always useful, no matter what the situation, positive or negative. Whenever a philosophy or, in fact, even a religion becomes popular, inevitably there are people who are going to use it in a way that essentially is a misunderstanding of the original idea or a significant distortion of the original idea. This is happening, not surprisingly, also with Stoicism. There's a number of people, especially certain kinds of young men, who are attracted to what they think of as Stoicism because it validates their notion that a good person, a strong person, particularly a strong man, is somebody who is silent, who controls their emotions, and so on and so forth. But that's Stoicism with the little s. It's the Stoic attitude, the stiff upper lip, the suppression of emotion, the Spock approach to life, which is not, in fact, what real Stoicism with a capital S, Stoicism the philosophy, is about. Of course, like any misconception, there's a grain of truth. The stiff upper lip, for instance, comes from the fact that endurance is in fact a Stoic value. The Stoics would say, look, if something is going to happen to you that you cannot do anything about, then your only choice is really, your only rational choice is to endure it. What are you going to do? You're either going to endure it or you're going to endure it and then complain about it. Complaining doesn't really add anything. It only makes you feel worse. So just deal with it. Just endure it. But that's not the same as a stiff upper lip, because it's only a minor component of what Stoic philosophy is about. The notion, the misguided notion that Stoicism is about suppressing the emotions also comes from a distortion of a real aspect of Stoic philosophy. The Stoics make a big deal about the notion of talking to your emotions, of modulating your emotions through reason. For instance, dealing with your anger in a way that it's not anger anymore, but it becomes something healthy, something positive. For instance, a sense of justice that you want to pursue instead of a destructive sense of anger. That can also easily be misconstrued as suppressing emotion. There is no such thing as suppressing emotions. We cannot suppress emotions because emotions are part and parcel of the way our brain works. The only way to suppress your emotions is to literally cut off a part of your brain, and that will turn you into a psychopath or otherwise somebody who has serious mental issues. You don't want to do that. However, there is a danger of what I sometimes refer to as the broification, as in bro, of Stoicism, of this interpretation of Stoicism that tends to be on the darker side of things, tends to emphasize masculinity, and tends to emphasize this view of, mythical view almost, of the man who doesn't really react in any external way to things and just takes it and then is stronger because of that. One of the arguments that these people make, for instance, is that Stoicism is a type of virtue ethics, and that the word virtue comes from the Latin vir, V-I-R, which in fact means man. So there you go, right? Even the etymology tells you that it's about being a manly man and that sort of stuff. But that argument misses an important, crucial point, which is the word vir itself, virtue in Latin, is actually a translation of the original. The original was Greek, because Stoicism ultimately is a Greek philosophy, not a Roman one. And the original word in Greek is arete, A-R-E-T-E, which just means excellence. It doesn't mean manly anything. It just means do the best that you can. And it's gender neutral. It's not a masculine, word at all. So, even at that level, we see sort of a superficial understanding. Even at an etymological level, and certainly at a historical level, we see a superficial misunderstanding, which turns into what I think is a counterproductive and potentially even dangerous kind of attitude. Stoicism certainly does not condone a manly man approach to things. The ancient Stoics themselves actually were unusual among Greco-Roman philosophers, because they explicitly said in writing that women are rational human beings just like men, and they're just as capable of understanding and practicing philosophy. It's right there in, black and white. It's in the writings. It doesn't need any interpretation. Both Epictetus and Seneca explicitly say that in multiple points. So to pretend that somehow this is a manly thing and that women need to be treated differently is just not Stoicism, demonstrably not the case. Also, if we're talking about virtue, well, the Stoics try to practice multiple virtues. One of these is justice. And justice is interpreted by the Stoics as treating other people, any other people, regardless of gender, race, nationality, ethnicity, religion, or anything else, any other people with dignity, with respect, in the way in which you yourself will want to be treated. So it's clearly nothing to do with a manly approach to things, whatever that means. Perhaps not surprisingly, many people approach Stoicism in a way that oversimplifies the philosophy. They want immediate results. They don't care about the historical background. They don't care as much about the complexities and the nuance of the philosophy. They just want something to work. And I understand that sort of need. At the same time, however, there's a danger in oversimplifying things. You may misconstrue things and you might act in a way that it's actually not at all in line with the philosophy itself. There are, for instance, two common ways to misconstrue Stoicism. One is to do Stoicism by quotations. So you find all over the internet snippets of Stoic quotes. Sometimes they're misattributed. They're actually not from a Stoic, but let's say from an Epicurean. One of the most amusing mistakes that you find on the internet, for instance, is that often people quote the Stoic Epictetus, but they accompany the quote with a picture of Epicurus, who was most definitely not a Stoic, and Epictetus would have been seriously disturbed by being mistaken for Epicurus. But this issue of quoting things is problematic because these quotation marks, the Stoics are eminently quotable. That is true. There is a lot of memorable phrases, sentences that you find in the Stoic texts. But when you abstract them completely from the background, they not only begin to make less sense, they actually might lead people to think in a way that it's contrary to Stoic philosophy. In fact, apparently this was happening already 2,000 years ago, because the Stoic Seneca, who lived in the first century, warns one of his friends, Lucilius, and he says, don't fall into the temptation of just quoting bits and pieces of our authors, because that will lead you to misunderstanding the philosophy. You have to read the whole thing. You have to read what Zeno was writing or what Chrysippus was writing, not just the bits and pieces, because otherwise you're not going to understand what's going on, and you are therefore going to act in a way that it's not in alignment with the philosophy. The other way to oversimplify Stoicism is to approach it as a series of life hacks, as opposed to a coherent philosophy of life. And perhaps one way to understand what I'm getting at here is to make an analogy with another very famous and useful philosophy of life, which is Buddhism. Most people associate Buddhism with meditation. And in fact, Buddhism does come with a series of meditations. There are different kinds of meditations that you can do for different purposes within Buddhist philosophy. However, it turns out that, empirically speaking, a lot of Buddhist practitioners do not actually meditate. And just because you meditate, that doesn't make you a Buddhist. What makes you a Buddhist is, for instance, to accept the Four Noble Truths or to try to follow the Eightfold Path to Enlightenment. That is the philosophy. That is what makes you a Buddhist. Whether you meditate or not, it's a different thing. Meditation is supposed to be an aid, a technical aid for doing the things that the philosophy says you should be doing. But people can achieve the same result without actually meditating. Now, that said, meditation is, in fact, a standalone meditation, is, in fact, useful. I mean, we have empirical evidence from modern medicine and modern psychology that meditation does certain things. It allows you, for instance, to deal better with chronic pain. It certainly reduces your anxiety and things like that under certain conditions. But those are not the goals of Buddhism, the philosophy. Buddhism, the philosophy, is not about anxiety or pain. It's about how to live your life. The same thing goes for Stoicism. Stoic techniques are, in fact, very useful, even when they are abstracted from Stoic philosophy. And proof of that is that cognitive behavioral therapy, the most popular evidence-based type of psychotherapy that we use in the 21st century, did originate from an inspiration from Stoicism, and it does use still today a number of techniques that are found in Stoic texts. But cognitive behavioral therapy is not a philosophy of life. You can be a very efficient practitioner of cognitive behavioral therapy. You can solve your day-to-day problems and still be a psychopath or behave very badly toward other people. That would not make you a Stoic. What makes you a Stoic is if you try to live your life in a reason-based, pro-social fashion. If you try to remind yourself that everybody on earth, every human being on earth is your brother or sister, that is what makes you a Stoic. Whether you actually do your evening meditation in the way in which Marcus Aurelius did or not, that's a practical aspect of it. It's a useful aspect of it, but that isn't what makes you a Stoic. One common assumption is that Stoicism is the antithesis of pleasure. In fact, often, if we're talking about Greco-Roman philosophies, Stoicism is opposed to Epicureanism. And most people think of Epicureanism as sex, drugs, and rock and roll of ancient philosophy, even though that description definitely would have been surprising to any ancient Epicurean. It is true that Epicureanism is a hedonistic philosophy. That is, it's a philosophy that puts pleasure, and specifically, in fact, reduction of pain, at the center of their philosophizing, at the center of their life. And it's true that Stoicism is not a hedonistic philosophy. It's a virtue ethics philosophy. It's based on character. The notion is to improve your character to become a better human being. However, the ancient Stoic Seneca himself says, I'm not stupid. I prefer pleasure to pain. I prefer to be healthy to sick. I prefer even to be wealthy to poor, if possible. It's just that those are not my priorities. That is, my life doesn't depend, the worthiness of my life does not depend on being rich. It does not depend on being healthy even. And it certainly doesn't depend on feeling pleasure. If I do have all of those things, sure, I'll welcome them. But those are not crucial. The most important part of life for a Stoic is to be a decent human being, a human being that acts reasonably and pro-socially. So, for instance, when I see articles that say such and such billionaire got his success by being a Stoic, I internally laugh or cringe, depending on the situation, because that's not what Stoicism is about. It's not about becoming rich or famous. Wealth, reputation, even health are what the Stoics call preferred indifference. An indifferent isn't, in Stoic parlance, something that you don't care about, as in the modern English word. It's something that literally does not make a difference. Does not make a difference to what? To your character. To who you are as a person. Again, the Stoics are very explicit about it. Epictetus, at some point, tells some of his students, he says, he is a non sequitur. A non sequitur is something that doesn't follow in logic, right? He is a non sequitur. I am rich, therefore I'm richer than you are, therefore I'm a better person than you are. He says that doesn't follow. What follows from the fact that you're richer than I am is that you have more money. You have more wealth. That's the definition of being richer. It does not follow that you're a better person, because being rich or being poor doesn't make you a good person or a bad person. The two things are completely independent. You know, the misconception about Stoicism is that it's about cultivating an attitude of detachment from things and people. Kind of like Buddhism. Often Stoicism is presented as the Western alternative to Buddhism. But there too, things are not quite that simple. For the Stoics, there is nothing wrong with caring about things and caring about people. We're human beings. That's what we do. It's just that those things do not define who you are, which for a Stoic is the most important thing. In other words, they don't actually define your character, your the way in which you behave. The ancient Stoic Epictetus puts it very nicely in an analogy that he uses with his students. He says, you should try to go through life as if you were visiting an inn or a hotel. While you are in the inn, that's your room. Nobody is going to come in just all of a sudden barging in. It's your room. The lamp on the table is your lamp. That's your table. That's your bed, and so on and so forth. So those things are, in a sense, yours. But you don't want to get attached to them, too attached to them, because you know that you are only passing through. At some point, you will be checking out and moving on to something else. And when you do that, you want to leave all of those things, the table, the bed, the lamp, in as good a shape as you found them, if not even better, because somebody else is going to use them next. The same goes with things and people in life. It's not that they're not yours in that limited sense. Absolutely. Enjoy your friends, your loved ones. Enjoy the material possessions that you have. But the notion of not developing too much of an attachment is in that particular sense. Treat everybody and everything as if you were passing through, because you are passing through. Absolutely take advantage of what's there, but then be ready to let go, because at some point you will have to let go. And your only two choices are you're going to let go graciously or ungraciously. Those are your only choices. Eventually things are going to go because you are going to go. One of my favorite metaphors by Epictetus that is related to this concept is the notion of figs in winter. At some point, one of his students is complaining because a friend of that student has just left. He went overseas, and so he's not going to see him possibly for years, maybe ever, and he's very sad and all that. And Epictetus says, well, what you're doing now is pining for figs in winter. You want, in other words, something that is not possible because it's not the right season. And Epictetus says, not only you should accept that right now it's winter and therefore you're not going to have your fig, but this should be a lesson to you to cultivate the notion that you should be enjoying the figs during the proper season, during the summer. And that's a great lesson, because very often we don't pay attention. We take people and things for granted until they're gone. And then this has happened to me as well. You know, when one of the things that triggered my midlife crisis that eventually brought me to Stoicism was the death of my father. And even though I knew that my father was suffering from cancer, in fact, he had been suffering from multiple cancers over a period of years. And as a biologist, I understand what cancer is. So I had a knowledge of what was happening. And yet I still went on my life as if my father was going to be there forever. And then something happened. He died and I was not there. I was not present. So I regret that, but I learned this. The lesson. And so I've lost other people since, and I internalized the figs in winter lesson, and I've been making and I'm still making a concerted effort with relatives and friends to actually be there and to savor that experience, to savor those fruits of life, so to speak, because I know that the summer is going to go eventually and it's going to turn into winter. And that way I will be happy. I will not be complaining about opportunities missed, because I will not have missed them. One baffling misconception for me about Stoicism is that it turns people into doormats. It's a quietist philosophy. It's about not reacting. It's about not doing things, just trying to retreat into yourself and sort of isolate yourself from the rest of the world. I am not sure exactly where that particular misconception comes from. If not, again, as a byproduct of the notion that Stoicism values endurance. But it's clearly contradicted by both the latter of the philosophy, by what you read from the Stoics themselves, and more importantly, perhaps, by the actions that we know those philosophers actually took in their life. In the Discourses, Epictetus gives us several examples of Stoics who, as we will put it today, spoke truth to power. In fact, there was a whole group of Stoic philosophers and Roman senators during the reigns of the emperors Nero, Vespasian, and Domitian, who were known as the Stoic opposition. These were people who were actually going to object to the dictates of Nero, Domitian, and Vespasian because they saw them as tyrants. And liberty, freedom, independence, those are actual Stoic values. And a Stoic could not abide by a tyrant. So these people risked their lives. In fact, some of them lost their lives as a result of a direct opposition to tyranny. There are other examples as well. Seneca talks a lot about a guy named Cato the Younger, who was a contemporary of Julius Caesar. Cato opposed Caesar on the floor of the Senate. They were both senators at one point in their political career. And Cato saw Caesar as increasingly developing sort of tyrannical aspects to his way of doing things. And so he opposed him on the Senate floor for many years. Then at some point, famously, Julius Caesar picked up arms and moved to war against the Roman Republic. He crossed the Rubicon River, famously saying, you know, the die is cast. In other words, I am now cognizant of the fact that this is irreversible action. Well, what did Cato do? He thought, okay, the time of debate is over. I need to pick up arms as well. And so he organized an army and he led an army against Julius Caesar. So both Julius Caesar and Cato the Younger pick up arms, there is a civil war. It's a horrible thing, and there's nothing civil about it. Lots of people die on both sides. Eventually, Julius Caesar prevails because he was an excellent general, and he defeats the Republican army. So now Caesar is after Cato. He wants to capture Cato alive because he wants to use him as a political piece. He wants to essentially show his magnanimity by saying, here is my enemy. He actually picked up arms against me, but I'm okay with that. I'm going to forgive him. But Cato was a man of principle, and he was not about to let Caesar take advantage of the situation that way. So Cato decides that the only way to avoid that is to take his own life, to commit suicide. The Stoics have a whole literature about suicide. They take the issue very, very seriously. They say that it ought to be the last resort, only under extreme circumstances. But Cato finds himself in a last resort under extreme circumstances. So he very calmly prepares himself. He sends away his friends and his loved ones, picks up a book. We know actually which book he read. He read one of Plato's dialogues about the nature of the soul. He has his dagger nearby. He picks up the dagger and he stabs himself, as the Roman did, in his stomach. However, he had been injured in battle, and so his hand, particularly in his hand, and his hand was not strong enough. So he falls down, makes noise, therefore, and so everybody rushes in from the other room, and a doctor sees what's happening. He realizes that no vital organ has been punctured, even though there is a mess around, the blood all over. And so the doctor tries to stitch the wound, to put back things, and then try to save Cato's life. Cato, in the meantime, comes back. He had lost consciousness. He sees what the doctor is trying to do, pushes the doctor away, reaches with his hand inside his own guts, tears them away, and throws them on the floor, thus dying. It takes a lot of courage and determination to do that sort of thing. I mean, I think that even the first part, the taking your dagger in your hand and stabbing yourself, that takes courage and determination. But going as far in the second bit as Cato did means that this was a man who had a high sense of honor, a high sense of his own virtue, and a high sense of what of the meaning of his existence. Caesar realized what had happened, and he was really upset about it. He admitted that Cato had bested him at this. And in fact, Cato became a hero of the Republican cause for many, many years afterwards. So here we have an example of a Stoic who actually was fighting and eventually died as a result of understanding what the right thing to do was and wanted to do the right thing, not endorsing injustice, not retreating into a passive, you know, inactive situation. So that should be inspiration to modern Stoics, not necessarily in the sense that we're going to have to pick up weapons, hopefully, against anybody. But certainly it is about speaking out. Certainly it is about defending one's own liberty and other people's liberty. It's about personal autonomy and the autonomy of other people. And whenever you see, as a Stoic practitioner, you see those things threatened, you really ought to speak out. It's your duty as a Stoic practitioner to do so, and then face the consequences, which may not be pleasant, of course. One of the features of Stoicism that I find most attractive is that built into the system, there is an openness to new ideas and to adjust the philosophy internally so that it adapts to whatever it is that we may discover moving forward. In fact, one of the ancient Stoics, Seneca, writes at one point that, look, the people that came before us are not our masters. They're just our teachers. They knew a lot of things, and some of those things were very useful, and that's why we adopt them. But that doesn't mean that they discovered everything. That doesn't mean that there are no new things to be discovered. And if we do find new ways and better ways of doing things, Seneca says, the only rational thing to do is to adjust our philosophy accordingly and move in a different direction. Stoicism, of course, is a philosophy that is over 2,000 years old. It started out in the 4th century BCE in Athens. You might expect that some things that we've learned in the meantime might be problematic in that respect. That is, the Stoics didn't know everything that science and even philosophy have achieved over the intervening almost 2.5 millennia. That means that if you're a practitioner of Stoicism today in the 21st century, you cannot simply take everything that the ancient Stoics said and go with it. Pretty much in the same way in which nobody today is a practitioner of, say, Buddhism or Christianity, in exactly the same way in which people were practicing Buddhism or Christianity 2 millennia or 2.5 millennia ago. For instance, the Stoic concept of providence is both interesting and beautiful on the one hand, and yet I think deeply flawed and needs to be rejected on the other. And this is going to have practical consequences. Let me back up for a second and explain what this is about. The ancient Stoics were pantheists. That is, they believed that God is the same thing as the universe. It's coincident with the universe. And therefore, they thought of the universe itself as a living organism endowed with reason. Right? The universe is God. Nature is God. God is thinking. And therefore, everything that happens in the universe is the result of the thinking and doing of God, the cosmos, or God, the universe. Now, I find this a very beautiful idea, if only I could believe it. As a modern biologist and as somebody who does a little bit, knows a little bit about physics, I don't think of the cosmos as a living organism. I cannot imagine that sort of connection. Now, you might say, well, so what? This is just a metaphysical dispute, right? The ancient Stoics thought about God and the universe that way. You don't think of it that way. What difference does that make in practice? Turns out it does make a big practical difference. There are a few passages in the discourses of Epictetus, as well as in his manual, where he says something really surprising, really interesting, and at the same time disturbing. He says, remember, when you go to sleep, kiss goodnight to your wife and your child, because they're mortal and they might not be alive tomorrow morning. That way you will not be disturbed. Now, the first time I read that passage, I thought, what kind of a psychopath is this guy? He's telling me that I should realize that my loved ones are mortals. I'm okay with that. Yes, we are. We're all mortal. And therefore, that means that at someday, I or them will die. But to say that I should remind myself of this so that I'm not going to be disturbed, are you kidding me? Of course I'm going to be disturbed if my daughter or my wife were to die. But then I understood where he was coming from. In fact, Epictetus himself clearly makes an analogy, an interesting analogy that shows where he's coming from. He says, look, you are like a foot that is part of an organism. Let's say that the organism, that the body has to get home. And in order to get home, it has to cross a muddy path. It is up to you as the foot to step into the mud. Now, if you think of that only from the point of view of a foot, without remembering that you're connected to a body, that's disgusting. Why would I want to step into the mud? This is not a pleasant thing. But if you remember that you are connected to a body, and then in fact your entire purpose in life is to bring that body wherever it needs to go, including stepping into the mud, then not only you're going to do it, but you're going to do it gladly. You're going to embrace, not just accept your fate, so to speak, but embrace your fate. So what Epictetus is saying there is not being psychopathic, as far as we can tell. He's just being realistic in the way he understood the world. He said, look, we're all literally bits and pieces of the God universe. And whatever happens to us, including the unpleasant bits, is actually for the good of the God universe. So if you understand things that way, not only you're going to accept what happens to you, you're actually going to embrace it. Now it makes sense when he says, you know, if your loved ones die, you should not be upset. You should not be disturbed, because you realize that whatever is happening, even though you may only get a small portion of that picture, but whatever is happening is part of this universal cosmic plan, and you should feel good about it, not distraught. It's a beautiful way of looking at life. Unfortunately, I don't think it's the right way to look at life. I wish I could bring myself to being a pantheist in the way in which the ancient Stoics were. That would definitely provide me with a lot of comfort whenever something bad happens to me or to my loved ones. But I don't believe in the cosmic God. And therefore, I think that whatever happens to us is the result of neutral forces. The universe doesn't care one way or the other. That means that I cannot avail myself of the Stoic concept of providence. So what do I replace it with? Well, acceptance is still part of it, right? I have to accept the reality of things. I am a biologist. I understand that people die. In fact, I understand that death is a natural part of the process of being alive, or the process of life on Earth. If other people had not died, I would not be here because I would not have been born. And so my death, the death of other people, it's natural. And as such, it's reasonable to accept it as much as one can at a rational level. But at an emotional level, I am still not going to be happy about it. And I think that's okay not to be happy about it. So that's one example of something that the ancient Stoics thought at a metaphysical level and had consequences in terms of their day-to-day life, their ethics. And modern Stoics have to modify, I think, because in the meantime, both philosophy and science have progressed to a point that makes the original idea untenable. In fact, if you're still not convinced, let me give you one more bit of evidence that that things work pretty much in the way I just described it. If one asks, well, what was Epictetus' argument for thinking that the universe is a living God? He does actually provide us with an argument. In fact, several of the Stoics do. Seneca does as well. And some of the other earlier Stoics, people like Zeno, who was the founder of the Stoic approach in the first place, does the same thing. They all use an argument from design. They say, just like the sword perfectly fits the scabbard, and that tells you that somebody designed both of those objects to actually fit together in a functional way, in a way that works. If you look around, you'll see that the universe is built in the same way. And frankly, if I had lived 2,000 years ago, I would probably buy into that argument. It's a really cogent argument. You look around the complexity of the world and you say, yeah, that makes sense. But I don't live 2,000 years ago. I live in the 21st century, which means that I live after two major objections were raised to that way of looking at things, so the design argument specifically. The philosopher David Hume in the 18th century criticized the design argument on philosophical logical basis and showed that it's not really coherent. And then about a century later, Charles Darwin, a biologist, actually proposed an alternative mechanism. We called it evolution by natural selection for why things seem to be designed in a certain ways. Given that knowledge, I have to reject the argument from design, as pretty much every biologist does. And if I reject that, then I also reject the Stoic view of pantheism. And if I reject that, I have to revise my notions of ethics and providence. So this is a good example, I think, of how all of these things work together. Scientific advancements will question our philosophical views, and it's a good thing if the philosophical views are able to adapt to what comes out of the new science. Of course, science in another century or 5 centuries or 10 centuries may tell us something different. And if there are Stoics 10 centuries down the road, they will themselves face the same problem and have to adapt somehow. I find that very refreshing because, unlike other philosophical or religious systems, which tend to be much more rigid, resistant to change, this notion that change is inherent in the way in which we do Stoic philosophy is very useful, very reasonable, and very refreshing.
Alrighty, ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for having joined us today. Ladies and gentlemen, we are saying goodbye and I'll see you again tomorrow from 1 o'clock to 4 o'clock.